The House Interim Committee on Education order for Tuesday, April 8, 2008. Welcome, members. We have Representative Roblin on the phone with us, and I believe Representative Clem is listening at home, too. I don't know if Representative Clem wants to call in and be linked up. But Representative Clem, if you do, I haven't been good until right now, why don't you call the majority office and they'll work that out for you if you'd like to be able to ask questions during the course of the hearing today. We are starting our interim work, members, and we're starting off with a very serious issue that came up during February. There were a series of articles concerning this issue, and a great deal of conversation concerning the instances of sexual abuse in our schools. And it's an issue that impacts people's lives. It impacts the life of any child who is abused by a person in responsibility and authority, and impacts that student for life. It can also impact a teacher who's wrongfully accused. It could ruin that person's career. It's a very serious issue, and it deserves our serious consideration. There's been some action, some statements made on this issue that indicate this might be a partisan issue. And I just want to make a comment here at this committee in the year and 3 months that we've been together. I think we have a track record of going after issues, exploring them, looking for every possible option. And it doesn't matter where the solution, proposed solution comes from. It can come from the Senate. It can come from Representative Greenlick. It can even come from Representative Huffman, as long as he doesn't do it at the end of a long debate on an amendment we're trying to pass. The idea can come from any source. This is not a partisan issue. There's not a single member of this legislature. There's not a single person here in the audience who doesn't take this seriously. There's not a single person who does not believe that even one case of sexual abuse is one case too many. I'm a dad. I have three kids. My youngest is 9 years old. He's in the third grade at Walker Elementary School in Ashland, Oregon. And any idea that I would put partisanship above the safety of my son is a disservice. I think it's a disservice to our work. We're a better legislature than that. We're a better state than that. So the plan of action, members, for the interim.
Can I comment?
Just let me finish up here, and I'll let you comment. Because we are going to take, again, I just want to emphasize, solutions from any source. From any source at all will be welcome in this work, and here's how we're going to go about the work. Today we're going to hear testimony from Teacher Standards and Practice Commission, and we want to make sure that people understand the work of the commission at a level similar to what the Senate has had the opportunity to understand. At the end of the February session, the Senate committee was able to hear testimony from Teacher Standards and Practices and the Attorney General's office. They had the opportunity to ask questions on the process for investigating claims of abuse. And they were able to really kind of bear down into trying to start the process to try to find out where any gaps might still remain in our system in terms of reporting abuse and making sure that there is no possible cover-up of any abuse in our system. Our goal for today is to get that information before our committee so we understand what the process is. In June, we'll be meeting jointly with the Senate committee. And between now and June, we're going to continue our investigation into what steps we can take to strengthen the system that we have. And we do have a possibility in June to brainstorm with the Senate committee, come up with the proposals, investigate those proposals over the months of July and August, meet again in September to come up with the specific proposals that we will pre-file or pre-session file for consideration in January of 2009. So once again, this is an issue that we're determined to make progress on, and every idea, every proposal is going to be welcome into this process, and the goal for today is to get a solid understanding of where we currently are. So with that, members, Vice Chair Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I'd just like to thank you for those comments and support your comments and make it a matter of record that Representative Flores is on her way here. Did form a work group, and I appreciate the chair asking her to participate today in the discussion. And I'm sure that she will be open and look like the chair looking for a solution. I was glad that the community staff member attended that meeting, and I think it was a positive meeting. I was able to attend by phone, and I think again it's supporting what the chair is saying. We're looking, everyone's working to find a solution. So thank you for your comments.
Thank you, Representative. And with that, I'd like to ask Vicki Chamberlain to come forward. and start us off. And members, you do have a good amount of information that Dana has placed before you for the use during the next couple hours.
Good morning, Chair Bunkley and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Vicki Chamberlain. I'm the Executive Director of Teacher Standards and Practices, and I've been in this job since June 2002. I gave your committee staff, and I understand she forwarded to you a lot of materials hoping to provide you some background. I haven't had a chance to spend any time with you. Is that better?
Yes.
Thank you. Talking at all about the commission and sort of what our role would be in all of this, I think the Oregonian articles actually did a very good job of describing most of the process. Frankly, I think they were, very careful to wend their way through that. But I just thought I have a few things. I have an outline, and I would like to invite you to interrupt me at any time to ask questions as they arise, because I think that might be a better way to do things. So let me just talk really quickly about the commission, and I don't want to belabor it, but I think it's important to understand that it is a state agency. The commissioners are appointed by the governor. We are an executive branch agency, and there are 17 members on the commission, and I this morning brought a list of those members for you so you can see their names. You might know some of them. That would be this document that looks like this. And the way the commission is designed, we have 4 elementary teacher representatives, 4 secondary teacher representatives, 4 administrators, 2 representatives from higher ed, 1 from the private colleges, and 1 from the public colleges and universities, and then 3 private members. And one of the private members must be a school board member. And they serve 2 3-year terms and are eligible by virtue of their actually working position if they're an educator. So if that helps. I also like to remind the committee that the agency was set up to do 3 things: to issue licensure to educators, and this is an important issue, and the reason I'm mentioning it is that we license teachers, administrators, school counselors, and school psychologists. We register charter school people who are not licensed teachers and administrators, and we certify, this is crazy use of terms, I know, school nurses, and there's only about 40 of those. But my point in telling you that is we have no jurisdiction over instructional assistants. We have no jurisdiction over coaches who aren't licensed. We have no jurisdiction over private school employees. And I raise that because those are issues that have come up sort of tangentially around this. And so there's a body of folks out there that TSPC just never looks at or has any reason to. The way our statutes are set up, we are required to license people who are in charge of direct instruction or running programs who are paid for from public funds. That's how it was designed. So there would have to be a significant sort of change in defining what our mission is if any of the rest of that came in. So want to also just note really quickly that we have about 62,000 active licensees, individuals, out there in Oregon. About 36,000 of those folks are employed in the public schools, and about another 2,000 to 3,000 are employed in the private schools. So, yes.
I have a question in terms of you brought up the issues of coaches. So just to really hammer that point, since many coaches are volunteers in our schools, you would have no jurisdiction currently over a volunteer coach.
Chair Buckley and members of the committee, that is correct. Whether they're paid or they are not paid, we wouldn't have any jurisdiction. Now, that does not mean the school district may not do background checks on them or reference checks on them. A couple of issues that have come up. And if they have direct unsupervised contact with children, then they must be fingerprinted. But we cannot fingerprint them. The Department of Education must. And if we could put into the parking lot the whole fingerprint issue, that's one entire dialogue, actually, about how that works between our two agencies and what the effect of them of that is. So I have in my notes a section to talk to you about fingerprinting. I know we had a recent article about that, too. Just by footnote, there used to be a statute that said if a person is coaching and any part of their coaching goes into the school work day, they had to hold a license with TSPC. And that statute was repealed a number of years ago. And I think it had a lot to do with districts having problems finding licensed people to do coaching jobs. And so right now there isn't any really definition of about that. I think the Department of Ed does have some rules that ask that they, you know, have first aid cards and other certain minimal training, but other than that, they don't have to have any kind of license related to teacher standards and practices. So, and on that note, I hope I'm not birdwalking too much here, but there's been a lot of press about some coaches, and everybody sees the word coach and sort of assumes they're in a public school, but you have to read those articles carefully. We've had a lot of press about people who are coaching or working in private programs, totally unrelated to the schools at all, or even unrelated to private schools. So it could be a private swimming program or a private tennis or private gymnastics or private coaching. So we use that term coach very broadly, but we may not in the education community have an opportunity to even have heard of them. So just as a reminder. And the other two things that we do, and the one we're going to spend most of our time on, is discipline. But we also approve the preparation programs for all new educators who, if a university runs a program here in Oregon, so we have the teacher prep and the administrator prep and the school counselor and the school psychologist. And the reason I bring that up is because questions have come up about what are our standards about preparing educators to know what they should know about behavior or conduct or ethics. And on that point, the commission is in the process of adopting a licensure exam for initial licensure that includes having to have knowledge of the ethical standards. And that's a big step for us. In fact, we'll be the first state in the nation to do that. But our standards are in the SAT document I gave you, Division 20. And the first part are the general expectations for educators. These are the administrative rules that the commission has written by your authority to write rules for conducting our business. And it's under these rules here that most of our discipline actions take place. So I'm not going to go through them, but you might want to look at them. They're actually quite interesting. But if you'll just turn to page 8 and put a crink in it and save it, we're going to come back to that because that's related a lot to that Rule 20-40, fingerprinting and some of our heinous crimes and some of the areas around child abuse. All right. So that's all I plan to say right at this moment about the commission. Do you have any questions?
Representative Kahn.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. Thank you for being here. I had just a brief question. How often does the commission meet, and if that's in statute, or do you regulate those meetings on your own schedule?
Chair Buckley and Representative Kahn, we are required to meet at least twice a year by statute.
Okay.
However, the commission is now meeting four times a year. We have met five times a year. We have the commission can call an emergency meeting at any time. One of the things we try to take into account is that since we have 12 actively employed educators on the commission, except for the summer meeting, we have to take those folks out of their job and out of the classroom. So we've tried to manage the workload. They spend two full days on their meetings. one full day conducting business and actually one full day doing discipline. And so we do that four times a year. We have a three-day meeting in the summer. So generally we meet in about January, February, January to February, March, May, August, and then a fall meeting. So
thank you.
You're welcome. All right, moving on. The next thing that I wanted to talk a little bit about, before I talk about the process, I wanted to talk, and I know we have some DOJ experts and things, so I don't know how you want to invite people in, but before we go too far, I want to talk about the use of the term mandatory reporter, because it's been mixed up and sort of misused, and I want to explain what it means for TSPC and then what it means, and you're going to, I think, get a background on that from the Department of Justice as it relates to being a mandatory reporter of child abuse. Most of us hear mandatory reporter in, I believe, education and understand that that's our duty to report any child abuse that we believe may happen or may have happened to the Department of Human Services or law enforcement, either one. And so that makes me a mandatory reporter. As a member of the bar, you're a mandatory reporter. As an educator, you're a mandatory reporter. Where it gets confusing is in the school district world, superintendents are mandatorily required to report misconduct to TSPC. But we never refer to them as mandatory reporters. It's just that they mandatorily must report. And so I think that we should probably figure out some way to make a distinction there. One of the issues that comes up is that not every educator is required to report to TSPC if they observe or believe there has been misconduct. In the legal community, if you're a lawyer, as soon as you sign up and pass the bar, you have a duty to report against colleagues or other people in the bar who you believe have engaged in misconduct. We don't have that for educators in Oregon. The only persons who are required to report to us about misconduct are chief executive officers of districts. So, and that would also include a charter school. So, I point that out to you just to tell you that unless the superintendent knows or is aware of the misconduct, there's a breakdown there in the system.
Just to clarify that, so a teacher who is suspicious of a colleague's behavior towards a student is not required to report that suspicion to their principal or anyone else?
Chair Buckley, that is correct. They are Time out.
Yes. Time okay, out. Please.
Forget about child abuse for a moment, please. Superintendents are required to report all misconduct as it relates to educator ethics to TSPC. That would be theft of time, theft of equipment. That could be criminal behavior, that could be anger issues with students, that could be, and it could also involve the issues we're here to talk about today, inappropriate relationships, abuse, boundary issue violations, misuse of internet. I mean, I'm just trying to give you sort of an example. There is a standard of behavior that's expected for educators. That's what superintendents are required to report to us.
Okay.
And if we know a superintendent had knowledge of misconduct and didn't report it, then the superintendent is subject to discipline on his or her license based on that failure to report the misconduct to us. They are required to report to us if they have an educator who failed to report child abuse. That would be also a violation, for example. So separate that from the duty to report child abuse if you reasonably believe it has happened to DHS and law enforcement. So this, the universe of superintendents reporting is great big. The child abuse is smaller.
Thank you, Chair Buckley. So the abuse cases that have been reported in the news and what we're aware of through your stats, have there been superintendents sanctioned? If there have been secret deals made, that tells me superintendents have been aware of abuse of some sort or misconduct of some sort. But if there's a secret deal made, then they haven't told TSPC. So have there been sanctions of numerous superintendents over the last few years?
Chair Buckley and Representative Huffman, no, because, first of all, we're not aware of those secret agreements unless somebody tells us of those secret agreements. I mean, it's because they're secret. I'm not trying to be flip, but I'm being sincere. If someone cuts one of those deals and no one lets us know, then it's impossible to know. We do have one active case right now of a situation where we are aware of an administrator having taken the position that they could sort of negotiate away their duty to report, and that's in front of the commission, and that's about all I could say about that. Some of the cases that have, I know that were in the paper, while they may have had an agreement about what they would say in terms of subsequent employment for that educator, they were reported to us. So, in fact, I think superintendents have been very good, at least as long as I've been here and that I've been aware of, about reporting misconduct and realizing that their license is at stake if they do not, and we do become aware. And just so that you know, it doesn't matter how old the misconduct is, so long as they have an active license, we can act on that license for up to 5 years after it expires. So let's say we found out today that a superintendent who was currently working or had a current license had entered into an agreement not to report to TSPC about misconduct. I would refer that to the commission.
If I could elaborate on that point, one of the cases mentioned was out of Grants Pass, that was in newspaper, and if this maybe helped clarify a little bit, the superintendent did report to TSPC. The law enforcement could not find enough to bring charges against the individual, but TSPC continued its investigation even after the district made a deal for that teacher to leave the district, and the teacher eventually lost his license. The deals can be made even if the report has been made to TSPC for a teacher to move on. In that case, two letters of recommendation were written. One was the kind of red flag recommendation, simply said the dates that the teacher worked with the district, and the second recommendation was for non-education employers, so they tried to red flag the individual as well. So, hope that clarifies. Representative Flores, you're welcome to join us. We have a place for you up here if you'd like to. All right. Absolutely. At your pleasure. At your pleasure.
Chair Buckley. Just for point of clarification, Vicki, did you say that school teachers are not mandatory reporters?
Okay. School teachers are not required to report to TSPC if they observe colleagues who engage in TSPC misconduct. School teachers who believe that their colleagues are engaged in child abuse, or anybody's engaged in child abuse, anybody even in the grocery store, then they are mandatorily required to report to DHS or law enforcement that they believe a child is being abused. But they could have knowledge, for example, of let's say that I'm making this up, an educator is stealing gym equipment and taking it home, and they don't have to report that, and you know, that's a theft of public funds and that's a violation. However, if the superintendent learns of that, the superintendent is supposed to report that. That would be gross neglect of duty. I will tell you, however, that most educators don't like folks behaving like that, that they're working around, and we get a fair number of complaints from colleagues. So we treat them as patron complaints, so to speak, but they, you know, believe that that ought to be taken care of. But often, by then, it has wound its way up to the superintendent, and we're getting a report from there, too, so it's very rare. We'll certainly ask the superintendent why they did not report it to us if it does beat its way to our door.
Just to clarify the point as well, if a teacher does suspect a colleague of some sort of sexual abuse and they report it to DHS and law enforcement, what's the communication loop for the school administration, district administration, and TSPC?
Well, currently superintendents are required to report to us within 30 days of when they reasonably believe there has been a violation of standards. So, and most superintendents don't wait that long. If there's a situation where somebody has been reported to DHS, we usually get a letter right away. That may be a good point right there to sort of take a little bird walk, because we may get that report, but we would have to wait till DHS and law enforcement are done. So that actually affects our stats. You know, the timeliness of how we resolve complaints was a big issue in the Oregonian. We start the clock the moment it comes in the door, but we would be waiting for law enforcement and DHS to complete their work in a child abuse case, which could take months and sometimes takes years. And then when they are done resolving it through their way, particularly if they do find there is criminal behavior and the person is convicted, then we can take action. And if they're convicted, then it becomes very easy and quick action, because there are a set of crimes under which the commission can revoke a license for life, and they're pretty hard to defend against if they've been convicted of them. So, but I just throwing that out, because if you average cases, it can look very bad if you're waiting for something to be resolved in another forum. But the Kohler case, on the other hand, the one that you brought up, I think is a great example, because the superintendent referred the report to us in April. He, I guess, cut this deal about recommendations with the educator in June, and we were able to revoke his license in October. So that wasn't, there are cases like that we do try to get through if there aren't any stumbling blocks. There wasn't enough for the DA to prosecute, so that wasn't something that stood in our way on that case.
If I could follow just for momentarily, so a teacher makes the report to DHS and law enforcement. Is a teacher also required to inform the school superintendent, the principal of the school?
That I would be more comfortable if someone from a school district talked about that. There are policies. I know Senator Walker passed a bill about the chain of command, that they are supposed to report it to their immediate administrator, and I think most school districts have policies that they also are supposed to report up to their superintendents in their board policies. There, it's not our requirement that they would do that.
Okay, so. Thank you.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnitz.
Thank you. Ms. Chamberlain, does your agency and your commission not feel that you, when we're making this reporting and you're not in the loop, wouldn't it would help this situation, been preventive if you had been in the loop and we might have prevented some secret deals? The more people are involved, especially our state licensing organization, agency. In other words, you're saying you're not in the loop when it first is reported. It goes to law enforcement and to DHS. Why wouldn't you want to be in that loop?
Chair Buckley and Representative Wisnitz, I think maybe I didn't mean to say that exactly. What I'm trying to say is that there isn't a requirement in the law that they call us the same time they call DHS and law enforcement right now, and there isn't a requirement in the law for us to also tell districts how it would go up to superintendents, and that's how I understood the question. We believe there is absolutely a requirement in the law, in our rules, that the second the superintendent finds out that they need, not the second, we give them 30 days, but they need to report to us that they have a reasonable belief that somebody may have been engaged in child abuse. So I hope you didn't misunderstand me. But there is a related point on that, which is I think some work that we can do, and actually I did put in a legislative concept on this, and that is that there is a limited number of folks who are required by statute. Let me say this differently. DHS is required to release child abuse reports to a limited number of folks. And we have never been successful in getting those reports. And so we're going to ask the legislature to put the commission's name on that list of agencies who are eligible once a report has been completed, if it involves an educator, so that we can have that information to take appropriate action. It's almost virtually impossible to get those reports.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lim.
Thank you very much, Chair Buckley. My concern is that the teachers could be wrongly accused from the another teacher in the same school. That's my great concern. But in that cases, the superintendent or the principal has to report to the TSPC, or do they have a right to investigate themselves whether this is truly happened or not? When it's reported and to the TSPC, they have to go through such a great length of investigations, even though the person wrongly accused. And that's my concern. What do you do about that?
Chair Buckley and Representative Lim, I think there's two protections there. One of them is that, yes, superintendents are given the discretion to do investigations and to decide that they don't believe there's been a violation. So it could stop right there. And if it was reported to us differently, the superintendent part of the investigation would be the superintendent explaining to us why they reasonably believed there wasn't a violation and that the person was innocent. That's one protection. The second protection has been built into the law for 30 years, and that is that if TSPC gets a complaint about an educator and the investigators determine there is just insufficient evidence, or maybe no evidence at all to support the complaint, we refer that to the commission, and under the statutes, all of that information becomes sealed and confidential so that people can't pull up the reports or pull up the information on the false accusation. All right, so I think that's a real important thing to remember. This set of cases that I gave you, that long piece of paper with the yellow, has, just because the case comes to the commission doesn't mean that that educator is going to be disciplined. Part of our job is to do an investigation, and I have a very highly trained investigative staff. We have three who have law enforcement backgrounds, one with a legal background, and the other one who has been through investigator training. So we're kind of pleased with that. But this piece of paper I gave you here, let's just look at the very top line across here. These would be the cases that the commission considered.
Mr. Chair, I have just one more follow-up question.
Go ahead, Representative.
Okay, thank you. Another issue is that I believe most teachers are very sincere in reporting some kind of abuse happened, but some cases may not. If one teacher accuses another teacher in a wrong way because of the personal issue, because I don't like the person, whatever, I try to give the person hard time, what provisions do we have the teacher who wrongly accuses another fellow teacher? Are they go just free, or because the person reported the way, even though it's not, do we have any provisions for those teachers, penalizing them for wrongly accused?
Chair Buckley, Representative Lim, I'm trying to think through the hundreds of cases I've seen since I've been in that job and whether I have seen that.
Okay.
I don't believe I have seen that. I think that, first of all, if a person accuses another person, the person who is accused learns who the person is who did that. That's a important piece here. So, you know, the only time we will take anonymous complaints is if it is involves the issue of student safety and somebody says they're fearful about their name being disclosed. There's nothing in the statute that says we have to disclose it, and we will protect the complainant in order to follow the information in the complaint. So could we prosecute someone if they maliciously reported someone? Right now, I don't think we could. It would be hard to prove. I haven't seen it yet. It would be really mean-spirited, no question. So, but we that just I have not seen that yet.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Chair.
Unless you're
Chair Buckley, thank you. Vicki, what would happen if, okay, it's kind of following Representative Lim's thought, okay, I had a relationship with a teacher and then he jilted me, and so I'm disgruntled. I live in a whole other district, another part of the state, but I write you a letter and saying, gee, Joe Smith just is a schmuck. And you need to investigate because of XYZ. What happens then?
Oh, we had one of those last meeting, actually.
I'm not surprised.
Well, we dismissed the case. There, Representative Comp, there was nothing there. It clearly turned out to be a sort of a marital relationship gone sour, actually, and it was one of those situations, and I can't even really truthfully remember if they were married. They were certainly very close. That was sort of the direction I was headed. The investigator spent a lot of time, went and talked to a lot of and determined that this was, you know, a tempest in a teapot, and there was absolutely nothing to it. It actually involved two educators that the person had complained against, and so we took those names to the commission, and they were part of the stats I was trying to show you that got dismissed. And so we wouldn't release their names, that, you know, or anything like that, but we have the file and it's been closed. And so, yes, I have seen that. But I have not seen colleague-to-colleague malicious reporting. I have not seen superintendent malicious reporting. Not that we were aware that was the intent, but we have seen patron. We see a lot of patron complaints in June at the end of the school year when they're be unhappy about grading or unhappy about some conduct the student reported earlier in the year, but the parents are a little worried about their child being, you know, protected. It's usually about some perception that the teacher hasn't been fair to their child, but we know the second that school is out, we're going to get about 50 complaints, and they're going to be mostly from patrons, parents, and things like that. That's just something we expect at the end of the school year.
Did you want to? I'm sorry, we interrupted you when you're trying to make a point about your.
Well, I just wanted to show you something that doesn't get talked about. Obviously, is the work the commission does is not just the cases that they end up charging and taking action against the license. So I was looking at this top line here. The commission did 61 cases. They charged 9 educators. They adopted 17 orders. And what that means is that we can negotiate with educators an order, a stipulated order, that they agree, yes, this happened, these are the facts, and I'll take the reprimand or I'll take the probation or the suspension. So the commission took forward action about believing there was enough evidence against the 17 and the 9. the nine people got notice that they have a right to a hearing, and then they dismissed 17, and they took no further action against 17. And it's reported that way. That's how we track patron complaints against district complaints. So if you go to the far right-hand side, you'll see also, as of the last meeting, we've received 40 reports from school districts and 17 from patrons. So since February 8th, the commission has received 57 new complaints. Mm-hmm. Now, we knew this would happen with the articles. It creates new awareness. And so every time there's sort of something about this publicly, there's a rise in the number of cases that get reported. But just so that you can read, that's sort of how you would read these stats. If you went down the first yellow column, you could just see at each meeting the number of cases that the commission has addressed. In February, doing 61 cases at a February meeting is sort of unprecedented, because if you'll see the 68 below there, that was an August meeting. That's a three-day meeting. We could make more time. And you go the next one, 67 down below, in August 06. So that was the third highest number of cases the commission's ever considered. I can tell you it will be very close to that in May as well, because we've already completed 32 investigations. So,
if you could just clarify, a patron is used as a parent or a student?
Anybody other than the superintendent who's required to report gets put in the patron category.
Mr. Chair.
President Krimmel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chamberlain, I was noticing the dates, January, March, May, August. It appears as though the commission meets, what, every other month? Am I correct in that?
I will.
He stopped himself. Go ahead.
If you look here, we've sort of played with all kinds of numbers. We have five meetings a year, four meetings a year. We're trying to get down to four meetings a year and making them a little more meaningful, because I think I said this a little before you came in, Representative Krummel, and that is so we don't take the educators out of the classroom any more than we have to. So we're trying to do it three times a year during the school year and one long meeting in the summertime. And we did commit to the legislature that if we felt like we needed to have extra meetings, we would. So far, we think that we have a solution for that.
Okay. I was just wondering about that, if meeting more often.
Arnie, you're not on mute, just so you know. Thank you.
Thank you. And that was the record. Okay.
I was on mute.
Yeah, you were.
No, you're not. But we enjoyed your conversation. I'm just wondering if meeting more often, especially given the number of cases that right now you have pending and the number of, and I realize that, because of the article in February, the number is spiking and that sort of thing, but I'm just wondering if it wouldn't be a short-term, solution to have the commission meet more often, but maybe if they're already up to date with what's going on in the investigations, then it becomes a moot point.
Chair Buckley, Representative Krummel, I think I was with you to your last sentence. I'm not sure exactly what I think you meant there. One of the things I think is critical is to give the investigators enough time to do a good job completing an investigation. And so that's one of the things we've been trying to do. I identified in a letter to Representative Buckley and Senator Walker at the end of the session sort of where we thought we were with our caseload. And we had already been prioritizing cases, only we took a much more aggressive stand since then. And so we put together this sort of report for you on where we are on that. And I think that a couple things here. We looked at, well, right now we have 348 pending cases as a result of the sort of bump we had from February. We have already completed 31 investigations on the priority list, and that would be this first paragraph up here. So at the end of the session, we were very close to 300 cases, and at that time, we had identified 19, this is based on the allegations and what little we knew at that point of the investigations, 19 that were related to sex abuse, 23 related to boundary violations, and that would be somebody is reported to us to have an inappropriate relationship. Maybe they're calling them after school or texting them or talking online. There can be just a number of things. But it isn't really in the report an allegation of touching. But it is an allegation of a suspicion of a just too close of a relationship. And 22, I say assault. These would be anger issues where somehow someone is accusing a teacher of touching somebody in an angry way, not in a sexual way. Failure to report child abuse. All right, that's what this 8 cases is, not failure to report to TSBC. And sexual conduct with adults, we had 9 reports of that, and that tends to be more of a sexual harassment and employment area a possibility than a child issue. And 3 internet misuse cases. And at that time, of those 84, we've completed 31 of the investigations. However, in the meantime, of the new cases that have come in, of the 47 that came in, if you'll look down here at the bottom, this is how we have categorized them. We had 6 new reports of sex abuse, 9 boundary reports, 13 assaults, 1 we did get done, 5 involving drugs or alcohol, and 2 have other safety issues. The investigator may have interviewed the educator and believes that that person may have issues that weren't reported. So that can happen. We didn't have any failure to report 3 sexual conducts with an adult and 1 internet, just to sort of give you an idea. So I say that because the entire office's focus are on these cases right now, which means the other cases are going to wait. And they have to. I mean, the sort of the smaller cases. I mean, it's critical, I think, that we get the ones that were concerned about the student environment or student safety dealt with as quickly as possible. And as soon as we can get these into a stage where we know that we have them managed, we have them moving, and they're moving forward, we can start incorporating some of the other cases. I know investigators who are waiting on police reports or waiting on other reports will pick up another case, but just to sort of give you an idea, there was something I was going to say there, but it flew the coop.
Representative Crimble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chamberlain, another question that just kind of popped into my mind as you were talking about looking at the priorities and cases being resolved, and now with these new cases, these other ones have to wait and that sort of thing. And I don't know if the if a commission, a regulatory commission such as TSPC, has the same standards as the criminal system or not. So I guess I'm just going to ask, is there anything to do here? You know, one of the things that we're guaranteed constitutionally is a speedy trial before our peers. Well, obviously, with a regulatory commission, it's a little bit different ballgame. But if there's a case that has been put on hold and then put on hold again and then put on hold again, is there a potential that a teacher that has been accused would have a is that the Fifth Amendment? Is it? Anyway, would have a potential Bill of Rights complaint against TSPC for not moving their case along and not bringing it to a conclusion, irrespective of what that conclusion is, whether it's guilty, not guilty, no further action, whatever the case may be. Is there a potential for that?
Chair Buckley and Representative Kummel, I don't think so. A lot of times educators don't even know complaints are in our office until we let them know, and we don't let them know until we're ready to start the investigation for a couple reasons. One of them is that you're correct. That's not fair to say, oh, we received a complaint on you today, and, oh, by the way, we might get to it in 18 months or 24 months. That would be really not fair to somebody. And the second reason is that we've learned the hard way that people can't resist trying to help us in advance by talking to witnesses or whatever. So we try to be fully engaged in their case when we're going to investigate. Once the commission begins the investigation and collects the evidence and then completes the investigation and decides that they have enough evidence to charge the educator, at that point, everything has timelines and starts to move. We are required to give the educator notice that the commission has enough evidence that they believe that they found a violation and they'll charge him, and the educator has 21 days to ask for an administrative hearing. And if they ask for an administrative hearing, we send it straight to the Office of Administrative Hearings. We hand it over to our assistant AAG, who is here today with me, and it starts moving through the process. And that's when their sort of speedy trial, if you will, becomes subject to the courts, just like any other criminal action and the scheduling. But it's generally not too long. So, but if somebody made a false accusation against you, you would only know if the person who reported you told you until we contacted you.
And if I may follow up, Mr. Chair, and at that point, if you contact me, you're saying, A, we've had a complaint, B, we have enough evidence, and C, you have 21 days to request a trial, a hearing.
Representative Buckley and Chair, you got me all nervous there. No.
Sorry, not trying to make you nervous.
We will contact you when we start the investigation, and I have insisted, and at the commission's insistence, that every single educator must be interviewed by the investigators. We have to have a direct contact with you. You have to have the opportunity to tell our investigators that this is or is not true, or we won't just go swoop out there and talk to people and come in and say, you know, we're done investigating you. You will be the first person we're going to be talking to say, here are the charges. What do you have to say about that? What more do you want to add about that? And because it really helps guide the investigation a lot. I mean, if you say you're innocent, then we are going to see if that's true. And if you admit it, then we'll take it in another direction. And I have found it is almost never exactly like it comes into us on paper. So it would be really wrong to look at, you know, it without making sure we've been in touch with you. So the speedy stuff only happens after the investigators are all done talking to witnesses, talking to you, talking to whoever, and then they write a report, and then we take it to the next commission. And that's a really good point to tell you sort of how that works. The investigators do not make recommendations to the commissioners. The investigators complete their reports. They bring that all in to me. We sit down, and I personally make a recommendation to the commission about whether I think there's enough evidence to charge or enough evidence to dismiss. Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not making legal decisions there or anything. In fact, we will often consult with our AAG and say, well, here's the evidence we have. You know, do you think this is enough to take to a hearing? Because that will have a lot to do with what we will recommend to the commission. And I bring that up because it came up actually in the news article in Grants Pass, because the educator who actually ended up getting revoked, the first time that the educator was reported to our office, we were unable to find enough evidence to do anything against that person's license. If nobody cooperates with us, and I mean in particular students, it becomes a he said, she said, or she said, he said. I mean, however you want to look at it, we have to have some valid quantifiable, usable evidence in order to move against a license. And I really recommend, if you have time, that you consider inviting some people from Homeland Security and or the FBI. They do fascinating jobs of explaining some of the psychology behind compliant victims. And that's something we run into a lot in the school arena, because high school girls in particular may believe they are in love with an educator, or it could be a high school boy. But teenagers often don't want to hurt somebody that they think they love. And the experts on this are the folks I cited. We brought them in to talk to the commission so the commission could understand this whole, why these cases sometimes fall apart at the end. And they may not be, there may not be enough evidence for a criminal prosecution. And if we can't get one of those victims to be willing and brave enough to come forward, it's very difficult, almost impossible for us to take action also.
Well, I have another question, and it has to do with the reporting. And if this was already covered, Mr. Chair, you can tell me to go away. But I'm curious about something with regards to the reporting, because educators are mandatory reporters. And one of the things that came up in the article in February was this notion of school districts, quote unquote, passing the trash, moving educators out of one district, and they get hired by another district, either in state or out of state. How do we rectify, and how does the commission rectify, and how does the superintendent, quite frankly, rectify this notion that, okay, we've got this teacher, we know that they're abusing kids, and we're just going to do a cut a private deal and make them go away and get them out of our school? I'm a superintendent, and I know that teacher's doing that, or I have reasonable suspicion that teacher is doing that. How do I rectify cutting that deal and not reporting to the proper authorities that this teacher is potentially abusing kids? And why aren't I, as a superintendent, then being charged by the commission for not reporting?
You go right ahead.
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, you would be if we found out. And occasionally we do find out if we found out. And that's a royal we, because I don't really have a vote on the commission. But, I mean, if the commission found out that you had, in fact, covered up knowledge of abuse or violation of our ethical standards, not child abuse per se, and chose not to report it or entered into agreement not to report it, then we would be investigating you and holding you up against the requirement that you be reporting to us as a superintendent and take action against your license. And so we would if we knew. And a few of these agreements we did know about. Others we still don't have any real direct knowledge of them. But if we find out about them, and we have a couple, then we do prosecute the superintendent in addition to the educator if there is enough evidence there.
So just as a clarification, Mr. Chair, thank you. So there have been a few where you know that the superintendent or that the district has basically, quote-unquote, passed the trash, and now you're talking to those superintendents, or you're doing an investigation against those superintendents to bring them to into compliance.
That's Chair Buckley and Representative Crummell, that's correct, but I just want to be clear again, and I don't think we can say this enough. That's if we finally violate our rules. All right? I mean, if the conduct violates our rules, would we be interested? So I think that's very, very important. I think you need to explore this very, very closely, because it's sort of all employment agreements have been captured into, you know, one arena, and I don't want to minimize. Please don't take me wrong, but, you know, there's all varieties of trash, if you will. Somebody may enter into an agreement merely because they hired somebody who just isn't working in the district. But they don't have any evidence that the educator has engaged in any misconduct at all.
Mm-hmm.
But they may enter into an agreement. You know what? If you resign, we'll just agree to give you a good recommendation. And I know those happen. The ones that I think got a lot of attention are the ones, and I think there's a lot of confusion about this, and I think it bears some exploration, and I'm certainly not the expert, but it is, what can I say after I release somebody I know who has been engaged in misconduct if they are looking for work somewhere else? If you've reported them to the commission and the commission couldn't find evidence that they'd engaged in misconduct, there isn't going to be any notice out there to school districts of anything on their license, because the action the commission takes attaches to their license permanently. It's just a permanent record. So let's just say that you had somebody you think engaged in misconduct. You reported them to us. We did the investigation. There just isn't enough evidence to charge them. We had to dismiss the case. You still sort of believe something happened. Something may have. We may not have been able to prove it. But you're not comfortable giving that person a good recommendation. So I think that out of fear of litigation and misspeaking and all kinds of things, people refuse to say anything. And it's an area that may need to be explored. I know different states handle that differently. And I'm going to try to actually loop this around to a bigger concept that came up, and that is that reference checks are only good if the person has an employment record. Right? I mean, and reference checks are only good if you think you're going to find out something about somebody who may not have a sterling employment record. But we get a lot of new educators who we have no idea may be headed toward engaging in misconduct. You can't reference check them. Or we get people who have no record of misconduct in other school districts who, for whatever reason, for whatever opportunity came up in the new school district, no reference check could have disclosed. No fingerprint check could have disclosed. Almost all of these people do not have records. So what the fingerprinting does that is excellent is it keeps other states' trash from coming over into our state without us doing that check, and so does some of their licensure actions. So I think that if they have behaved significantly enough that the commission takes action, their license is flagged. And those orders are now up on our web. Anybody can look up any educator. They can do an instant check on the name and see if there is a discipline that has happened and what the underlying facts were. But if there wasn't, if they just had a complaint into us, we would never tell them that it had come in.
Mr. Chair, there's only one thing that I'm concerned about was, and this doesn't necessarily require a response, Mr. Chamberlain, but is the comment about, if the superintendent, like in the situation that I was describing, if they followed the TSPC rules. It is in state law, teachers, educators are mandatory reporters.
Correct.
Period. I certainly hope that that is part of TSPC's ethics, and I hope that that's part of TSPC's rules, and if it's not, it ought to be.
I think she's going to point right to it.
Well, but mandatory reporters to...
Yeah.
The mandatory reporter in that case is mandatory reporting to law enforcement, not
law enforcement or DHS.
Yeah, right. But not to teacher standards of practice.
But my point is that if there has been a report levied against an educator for potential abuse or for whatever the case may be, that ought to be one of the reasons that TSPC, and actually if there's a license out by TSPC, either DHS or law enforcement should be notifying TSPC that they have had a person report.
That's a matter of statute we need to be thinking about. That's not in current statute.
Then we ought to get it in.
Yeah.
Representative Buckley.
I'll give Ms. Henry a chance to respond.
Thank you, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. I'm not putting my finger right on it, but trust me, if a mandatory reporter fails to report child abuse to the DHS or law enforcement, then it is actionable by the commission. And I have, I've only seen one or two cases that the commission didn't take action. In other words, it's fairly cut and
but
dry.
But that's if they fail to support, not if they report, not if they do report.
No, if they failed to report child abuse, you know, we would take action against that. And we have, and the timeline is very clear. And I know Ms. Gus is here from DOJ. You have to less than 24 hours. I mean, you have to do it right now.
Mr. Chair, that's not the issue. The issue is getting that information
to TSPC.
To TSP.
That's the question I was trying to get to earlier. What exactly is the process once the report goes to law enforcement, DHS? When is TSPC informed?
Well, only when the superintendent tells us if that person is employed.
Correct.
Otherwise, we don't have any mandatory rule that DHS tells us. We don't have any mandatory rule that a district attorney who may be considering anything against an educator tells us. There is nothing that we occasionally get, I don't want to say gratuitous, but I mean we get DAs who are conscious enough to refer things to us. So I'm sorry I misunderstood you and misheard you.
Can I go back? When is the school superintendent informed? From again, I'm sorry to keep going back over this, but if a complaint is made to DHS and law enforcement, when is the school superintendent informed of that charge against an employee?
Well, I don't know the answer to that.
I can answer that.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
The superintendent is informed that day. We fill out a form. Principals fill out a form in the office once that is reported, if that's reported to DHS and police. And then that
they notify DHS or police. I call the police and say there's the sexual abuse
going on. Oh, you call
the police.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't think the principal necessarily knows about it. I don't think.
If you're a school employee, they inform the administration when they make reports.
Is that by policy or by law? I mean, that's what we're trying to get
or,
to.
Or even either.
I do know a little bit about that, Chair Buckley. Actually, in the law, if it happens at school and if the educator sees it at school, then the educator must report to their immediate supervisor, and then that goes up the chain, and that's where the policies are. But if an educator engages in sex abuse and off-duty and the school may not know, that has happened. I thought that was the question you might be asking, and I don't know when the school folks or anybody else would find out about that.
So that's what you're referring before when you talk about a DHS investigation then being reported to you upon its completion.
Correct. Okay. Correct.
Then that brings us back again full circle to what I was asking earlier, Mr. Chair. If I'm a superintendent and I know and I've got a teacher that I just want to get rid of them because they're you know, there's reason to believe that they are doing this. So we're going to move them out, and it's a private deal. But I suspect, I have reason to suspect that they are, in fact, engaging in activity that is abusive or meets one of the standards. It is my duty to report that to DHS, both to DHS or the law enforcement and to TSPC because of the license.
Correct.
And if I fail to do that, and I move the teacher out, then I guess what I'm saying is that then at some point in time TSPC needs to be saying, wait a minute, you knew that this was going on, you failed to report it, and we're coming after you.
I believe that was the response that would be the case, that the school administrator would be in danger of losing their license and other penalties. I'm not sure what they would be.
Chair Buckley, it just depends on the facts. I mean, you know, what the circumstances were behind why they didn't report. The commission can only take four actions. They can reprimand, they can suspend, they can revoke for a year or revoke for life, and then they may have probation on any one of those except for the revoke for life. I do want to emphasize that not even in the child abuse reporting or in reporting to TSPC is the superintendent required to prove that they know anything.
Right. No, it's a suspicion.
Just a, sus-
It's just like if I suspect that a parent is abusing their child, and that child comes to school and they're full of bruises and welts and all of that kind of stuff, I have a duty to report that to law enforcement and to Child Protective Services. And if I fail to do that, I am in violation of Oregon state law. Period. And it's not, I have to go tell my supervisor, I have to report it. If I'm the one that observes it, I have to report it.
Correct.
Not to my supervisor, to the actual other authorities. And my point here is that if now as a superintendent, I've got this teacher named Comp that I want to get rid of because I think she's doing something, and I have reason to believe that she's doing these things.
Be careful, please.
Then I have a duty to report that, both to law enforcement and because she's licensed under TSPC, just TSPC. And if I have basically said, okay, listen, we'll just cut this little deal.
Is that latter really true? Do you have a formal duty to report that the teacher standards and practices?
Absolutely.
The superintendent.
Is that what the statute said?
No, I don't know that that's what the statute says. I have an ethical responsibility.
Okay.
I may not have a legal responsibility.
That's
so what we need to do is make sure that it is a legal responsibility. Because my point is that if we want to get rid of these special deals that have been cut, the only way to do that is to make sure that the superintendent is going to be held accountable.
Yep.
If they in fact do cut a special deal to move the trash out, to pass the trash, to move that person out, and they have failed to report it, because if you have, it's not beyond a reasonable doubt. It is, if I have a suspicion to believe, that's the standard that I have to use as an administrator, as a teacher, anything that's against a kid. If I see another teacher abusing a child, I have a responsibility. That's when I have a responsibility to report to my supervisor, but also I have the responsibility to directly call Child Protective Services and or law enforcement.
And
us within 30 days.
Absolutely. Representative Wisdom, you've been very patient. I'm going to let you.
Thank you. And I think, Mr. Chair, and I think my questions are for Mrs. Chamberlain would not be, I couldn't hold back for the other group. Because, okay, first question is, when did the mandatory reporting go in? Second is, because if you look at your cases pending, I mean, we've got a problem here in the number. From your February letter, I see you've hired two other people. So my questions are, when did mandatory reporting go in? How many investigators did you have? How many do you have now? Have you looked at, to get this backlog down, have you looked at contracting out for investigators? Because, you know, if you go from 34 pending cases to 210, that requires a different workload. I think that your agency has a responsibility. We have a responsibility to be sure you have the resources to do your job you're hired for. So, do we need to give you more money? I understand you have had some reserve money in the agency. And, do we need more? Do you need contract? Do you need temporary investigators? How do you get this backlog down? Of your statistics, your reporting is interesting, but I don't know how many cases you have that are over 120 days or over 190 days. I think that would be something that we'd want to be sure you don't have any old cases that are pending around for a year, especially if it's involving sexual abuse of our children. So could you respond to those, please?
Yes. Chair Buckley, first of all, the reporting statute, as far as TSPC goes to us, was first enacted in 1993 and has subsequently been revised and upgraded, but superintendents have had a duty to report misconduct to us clearly by administrative rule, which means law, since 1993. We did have, prior to the February session, one 2.5 investigators. One of those was a limited duration position that was given to us in the 2007 session. And after the February session, we were given permission to hire two more, and we did. We frankly do not have any office space for any more staff in my office right now, sincerely. And I believe that, and the two new hires have only been on board less than a month. I know that they've completed two or three cases, but investigations take time. And I believe, frankly, with the current staff of 4.5 investigators, that you're going to see some results by January. I think that some very good results, as a matter of fact. As long as we can control any of the timelines, we are continuing to move forward. On that note, one of the changes in procedure that we made that has and will speed up cases is if we find enough evidence to charge an educator, we will not negotiate about that before we take it to the commission. That used to be a practice, that if the educator was willing to admit to the facts that we would negotiate a settlement. That slows things down because then you're working with attorneys and you're working out agreements and you're sharing it with the AG. We have just decided if we find the evidence, we will go to the hearing and we will charge and we will move it in that direction because things then happen more quickly. There's incentives to settle more quickly and all kinds of things like that. So I expect to see some speed up on that. I want to come back to the contracting out issue because it's an interesting issue. But the other limiting factor is every single one of the commissioners does discipline, all 17 of them. And in order to handle, and you really want that because you want the teachers, the administrators, and the higher ed to be, they're a board. But there is a committee that has the primary responsibility for reading the cases, and if the other commissioners do not have time to read them, that's fine. But they all deliberate and they all vote. They always have. They have to by law, just like you all go down to the floor and vote. And so I say that if you want a good result, people need to be able to read everything, and that means they have to read the investigation reports and the evidence we collect and make a decision about whether they think my recommendation is accurate, and they don't always. They sometimes send it back when we recommend a dismissal to charge and vice versa, or back to do more investigation. We're doing a mailing right now this week, an early mailing, so commissioners can get a jump on reading these 31 cases, and then we expect to take another 25 or 30 to them. If we're doing 60 cases a meeting, we're going to chisel down that backlog very quickly. But 60 cases is very... I'm not going to say backbreaking, but you know it's quite a load. And what happens in this process is I think what you want to happen. It happens in executive session, but just like you have a floor session, they engage in debate, and you know do some quizzing of the investigators, and it's a very healthy process that I support. So I would beg you to give me a few months and, you know, see what kind of progress we make before we consider the resource issues. TSPC, prior to 1997, used to contract out all of their investigation work. And we had a contracted investigator who had completed an investigation, and at the end of that investigation, the commission decided not to charge the educator. All of those materials were confidential. That investigator shared all those materials with the person who originated the complaint, and the educator who had not been charged by the commission sued the commission and the investigator, and we lost. It actually took a long time to go through the system. Controlling contractors is extraordinarily hard, and when they're employees, if there's misconduct, I can take, you know, instant and immediate action, and I think that that has been the better route for us. I think, Representative Wissant, you will be, I think, pleased with our process. As far as the backlog and the age of the cases, some of that is dependent on, and I, you know, should have brought it with me, our confidential agenda, but we have about 35 cases that are pending in other jurisdictions, which could be DHS investigations, they could be criminal investigations. The cases that were referred to us because of the Union Baker misspent money, we had to wait for the federal government, the ODE, and the local law enforcement. Those cases actually, and they're in our books, 2 years, I think, before people finally said, okay, we're done, you can now do something. So the oldest case we have originated in 2006, but almost all of those are completed. So all of our backlog, almost, I would say 95% of it, was came to our office since January 1, 2007, 15 months ago. So I want to assure you that one of the things we did do in the last 18 months is critically tackle old cases and get them off the books.
Just thank you, Mr. Chair. I just thank you, Mrs. Chamberlain, for those comments, and we hope that that happens. I won't go into more details or questions, which I could follow up, but I'll take her comments and hope that that's the case that we're going to. Because, again, I think our responsibility is, you know, we hire her to do a job, but we want to be sure she's got the resources, and that's part of our main objective, to be sure she has resources to do it and hold her responsible. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you, Representative. Representative Lim.
Thank you. I might have a different set of questions in my mind, such as I'm not sure the clear definition what is abuse and what is love. Such cases either could be a male or a female, fresh out of college, and got the teacher's license and a teaching in a high school, and then a student, the senior, they could be over 18 years old, and inappropriation that the relationship might happen, not in the campus and outside, but they claim they love each other. Is that abuse, or it is love, or it is absolutely forbidden, the student and a teacher relationships?
Chair Buckley and Representative Kim, I'm going to tell you what I believe to be true, and somebody can correct me if they're wrong. If the student, if the K-12 student is over the age of 18, they are over the age of consent. They legally can consent as an adult to engage in. I don't believe that the adult can be prosecuted for engaging in a relationship. And however, that does not mean that TSPC would find that behavior acceptable. And I'm going to step away for a moment here and tell you there are many states who say, there's some states who have age of consent at 14, 16, and 18, and there are states who have agencies like us who actually, if they're above the age of consent, regardless if they're in the school relationship, they would then say they wouldn't do anything against the license. We've never done that. We say so long as the teacher is in a sort of fiduciary trusting relationship with that student, regardless of their age, if they're still enrolled in the K-12 schools, then in our opinion, it's just as objectable as if the person was 16 or 15 or 14 or whatever, even if we couldn't criminally prosecute them. So the action would be the same as if the conduct were criminal, so to speak. We would say we would ask for revocation. We don't want teachers abusing, administrators, anybody licensed by us abusing their relationship of trust with students, and regardless of their age. So, and that has actually happened more than once. But again, the issue for us is the issue that I mentioned, and that's getting the victim to cooperate.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. Representative Flores, welcome. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, very much. I appreciate the privilege. Ms. Chamberlain, just as kind of clarification of a couple of your earlier comments, if I might, and one dealt with you made reference to authority to hire two new legislators from the February session. Now, I do note that there was a budget note that was included in one of the bills regarding direction to the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission to report to the interim committees, and to the report should include factors that influence the number of cases, the actions taken to control the backlog, and any financial impact the backlog is having on the agency. However, our legislative fiscal office indicated that that was not an authority for the agency to do anything, that all executive branch agencies have the authority to create limited duration positions any time during the biennium. And in so doing, you were planning, the TSPC was planning to come before the E-Board in June to get additional limitation needed to pay for them. So could you clarify your reference to receiving authority to hire when you already had authority for limited duration positions?
Chair Buckley and Representative Flores, as far as I'm aware, my agency doesn't have any authority without either your approval or some approval from you to create limited duration positions. I know we can hire temporary positions, but not limited duration positions. The way I understood it, the authority to hire actually came directly from the Department of Administrative Services, who we are accountable to. And it was the agreement that was written up in that note. And so I'm wondering if you're asking me that if we had the authority all along, why we didn't hire investigators. And I didn't believe we had the authority without permission. Frankly, and I know we certainly didn't have the authority to spend the money without coming to you without permission to increase our limitation, and it would be extraordinarily risky to do that and then come and ask permission. So we have acted with DAS's approval and your approval in your budget note, and we will be there in June with the numbers. But I'm is that what you wanted me to say, or
I want you to say your understanding of what your authority was. I'm just kind of curious that Legislative Fiscal Office would indicate that basically you had already had the authority to do limited duration, which I would think has some bearing on temporary positions without any specific legislative or executive branch approval.
Chair Buckley and Representative Flores, I think the biggest influence there is taking the risk of creating positions within a budget that you know you don't have the limitation for. And I think what I was trying to say is that it would be good to know that you're going to have support when you come back and ask for limitation, that the legislature knows what you're doing in advance. So even though it sort of suggests that we could have gone ahead and created the positions anyway, I think that I'm not sure we would have gotten permission from the Department of Administrative Services without some legislative approval that they would be willing to increase our limitation at some point. I'm trying to be sincere here. I don't think any agency director would want to put the legislature in the position of saying, well, you know, we really had this backlog and we needed to hire people, so we went and hired them. Would you please give us more money? So I'm
that may be done from time to time as it is.
It might be.
Additional question, please. Mr. Chair? Thank you very much. Ms. Chamberlain, earlier you'd indicated that the Teacher Standards Practices Commission result or of whatever action has been taken against a licensed and credentialed individual is posted on your website. So the TSPC reporting requirement is kind of the focus of my question, and that is the type of information that you post usually, as I understand it, pertains to the Oregon Administrative Rule violation, is that correct, against the particular individual?
Chair Buckley, Representative Flores, in the order, I understand.
On the
web posting. I understand what you're saying. The statutes require that we do an annual list to school districts every year of people that have violated, and on that list, yes, it would have the name, and then it would just sort of have the rule reference or the statutory reference. But what we have done since then is you can go into general information on our webpage, click on TSPC discipline. There is a master list, and or you can go into any single year. But if you go into the master list, every educator who has been disciplined against by the commission since 2001 is listed there. There is a hot link to the order that was taken out against them, which includes a summary of the facts, the exact law that the commission applied, and then what the result was. Were they reprimanded? Were they suspended? Were they revoked? If they're going to be on probation at any point, and then what would be involved in that probation, and that is available at this moment.
Please.
So it would have the name of the teacher, a mandatory revocation, the date it was effective, and the administrative rule citation. And then what you're saying is there's an additional link now that might take to the charges that resulted in that default order, as opposed to just the administrative rule and the revocation, because I would suggest that's a very great improvement considering one of the most recent and local situations where the individual was posted with mandatory revocations, but his convictions were sex abuse 1, sex abuse 2, sodomy 2, endangering the welfare of minor, and rape 2. Those are pretty serious and might throw some pretty significant red flags out there. So is that what you were responding to, is to give more information on the types of the charges and the convictions that teachers were being revoked?
Chair Buckley, Representative Flores, yes. The commission has to enter into an order before they can take action, and the form of the order is a summary of the facts. So it would say this teacher was licensed by TSPC at this time. Here's the misconduct we believe happened. Here are the conclusions of law of why we think this misconduct violated the law. And then following that would be the order, and it would say, this teacher is reprimanded and must be on probation for the next 4 years, and during that probation they have to have an alcohol analysis, and they have to report to the commission every 6 months how they're doing after we hear about that report. All of that is at this moment. It's always been public information if anybody asks for it, but it is now available by link on the web next to the educator's name.
With that detail.
Yes,
with
that detail.
Yes.
Yeah.
An additional follow-up?
Please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Though I think the concern is some of the agreements that are reached before a report is made to TSPC, and that's kind of really the larger concern here. But does TSPC require a conviction before it pursues a case?
Chair Buckley, Representative Flores, no. In fact, very few of the cases we deal with actually involve criminal behavior. And if it does involve criminal behavior, then and it's in the list of crimes that the legislature has designated that we take it, that makes it easy. But no, we do not.
Are those the unwaivables?
Those are the crimes that are listed on pages 9 through 11 on this fat piece of paper I gave you that are fairly, I call them the heinous crimes. If you look at the top of page 9, it starts with aggravated murder.
Division 20.
Yeah, Division 20. Rape, sodomy, sex abuse, misconduct, bigamy, incest, child neglect and abuse, treason, prostitution. You've heard of that issue. Disseminating obscene materials, and you added 4 last session, and those are the last 4, the online sexual corruption and the furnishing sexually explicit material. And so if that's actually a good opportunity to talk about a little piece. If the educator is convicted of these, then we may take their license away for life. If they are not convicted of these, then really we can't take their license away for life. The commission can revoke their license for a year, and then the educator may apply to get it back, but they would have to prove that they're fit to be an educator, and sometimes that's really a tough burden to overcome. There's a lot of crimes on here that are not on here that are actually fairly serious, but the commission isn't authorized to permanently revoke a license except for in those cases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When we consider what happens to teachers after a report is made to an administrator, law enforcement, Department of Human Services, the concern is the child that's left in a victim mode or possibly to be re-victimized. Is a person against whom sexual abuse allegations or child endangerment in any way separated from classroom contact?
Chair Buckley, Representative Flores, yes, I believe you folks enacted a law in 2000, I want to say 5, might have been 7, but it's very clear that if an educator is accused of sex abuse, then the district is required to put them on administrative leave until that's been resolved. So that was a protection that you folks actually may be ahead of a lot of states on.
Thank you. One additional question, maybe one. And then when we talk about school districts who may be entering into these agreements without making that report, or prior to making any report, or never making a report to TSPC, what are the consequences to that district? And I think I heard you go through a little bit of a list, but that the administrator is held culpable for perhaps not reporting if in fact it's ever brought to your attention. But supposing it's not brought to your attention, supposing some of the instances that we read about are, you know, happening just that way, who's responsible? Who's held accountable?
Chair Buckley, Representative Flores, if we don't know, if we haven't reported or we're not aware of the agreement or we don't have any knowledge of it, sometimes we uncover them in an investigation, but not always. It's pretty difficult for us to do anything. I don't know who's accountable. The district is accountable, and I suppose superintendents are accountable to boards, but I did read that California's court ruled that those agreements were actually actionable, which was a good deterrent. And so, you know, a legislature can get ahead of a court, you know, and create a right of action against somebody. And my point in that is that let's just say that TSBC did not find out and an educator who had engaged in serious misconduct had been protected by one of those agreements and then had gone to another school district and had engaged in the misconduct again, the parents of the victim would have a right of action against the first school district under the way California law works. And so to me, that's about it. Unless we know, there's nothing we can do. And I don't know if you heard the part, but it doesn't matter how, if all of those secret agreements came forward today, if the superintendent who agreed to them had an active license with us, we could take action. So, but if their license had expired more than 5 years, you've removed our jurisdiction by statute to act.
We do have some folks in the Department of Justice coming up. You could ask these questions of them as well.
Thank you.
Anything further for?
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Any additional questions, Representative Kopp?
It's not a question, Chair Buckley, but I'd respectfully request from my colleagues here as legislators that I am highly offended by the term that the media has attached to this issue of trash. I would really ask us not to use that term and continue to breed a feeling of that educators are trash. It's really it really is offensive.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Buckley, we didn't get a chance to talk about fingerprinting, but you do need to talk to the folks from DOJ, and I'd like an opportunity to come back to you and talk to you about that whole thing. It's probably an hour's worth of interesting stuff. So, but it plays into this and what we do know or can't know about people when we do that. So,
very good.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, I'm going to get the Representative Wisdom first.
Along that line, Mr. Chair, thank you. Mr. Chairman, I think it would be very helpful, and I think the Chair would appreciate it. I know as a committee member I would appreciate it. You mentioned that we need to change it so you're informed by DHS or Department of Justice. You need to bring forth other ideas or other legislative proposals to make this, let's get this thing fixed and as quick as we can. And so we need your expertise, I would ask.
And we would welcome it
to bring forth legislative ideas of how to make it better to protect our students and the teachers.
Right. I'll do my best.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Could we, Mr. Chamberlain, could you send Dana a link or what the case is, this California case that you were talking about with regards to the actionable item against the district? And then you could maybe
absolutely
have Dana distribute it to
the Department of Justice folks might be able to comment on that as well, too. But it does do what the chairman said. It does provide that right of action.
Yeah. So if we could get a copy of the case, that would be interesting to look at. Thank you.
Chairman, thank you so much for your time, and we look forward to continuing our work with you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
I would just like to make note that New Mexico has also just passed legislation regarding settlement agreement confidentiality provisions that do not relieve responsibility for reporting. So there are models out there that will be very, very helpful for us as we look for some of the solutions here. And if I just might add another quick comment for Representative Comp's benefit, I'm sure everyone believes that most of them, all of our educators are heroes. And
thank you.
There are, however, 24,500 entries in Google under passing the trash, not all pertaining to education, but in various other professions, including law enforcement, including insurance industry and others, talking about, you know, the miscreants in their professions. So
okay. Thank you.
Just for your information.
Appreciate it.
Thank you very much. I'm going to have Linda Gus, Pete Shepherd, and Raul Ramirez, please, if you'd be so kind to come up and offer legal perspective on the issues that we are dealing with. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for your patience. Hope you've been following the conversation. And we look forward to anything that you would have to add to help clarify our understanding of the process.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepherd. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. I'm joined by Raul Ramirez on my right and Linda Gus on my left. Each of us are prepared to speak to some different aspects of the legal contours of the problem that you all face. My part of the contribution, the way I think I can best help the committee, is briefly describe the public records law as applies to the TSPC, and particularly as it relates to the TSPC's own practice. And Mr. Ramirez advises the TSPC on, I think, a virtually daily basis, and so he can speak to the committee particularly about the laws unique to the TSPC. And then Ms. Gus is our department's expert and indeed one of the state's experts on the mandatory child abuse reporting laws, and so she can, I think, perhaps help the committee on those features.
Excellent.
So I'll begin briefly. You should have received a copy of a public records order that the Department of Justice issued in December of 2007. It's in the form of a letter to the anonymous reporter who was working on a series of stories as to the TSPC. And as you know, the Attorney General has a role in sort of a quasi-judicial role in enforcing the public records law as it applies to state agencies. And in this instance, the question that came before our office to decide is whether there is an exemption in the public records law that would permit the TSPC to keep confidential settlement agreements that it reached of the character described in the in the order itself. There are three categories of potential settlement agreements that we addressed in the order: an agreement not to subject an educator to discipline, an agreement to not place an educator's name on its annual discipline list, or an agreement not to enter an educator into the national database. And so the question that we examined in the order that you have before you is whether there is an exemption under the public records law that would permit the TSPC to keep confidential those materials. The basic rule under the public records law, as you know, is that every person has a right to inspect any public record of a public body in this state except as otherwise expressly provided in the public records law. So when we're confronted with a question of the public records law, it's basically the presumption is that the record must be disclosed upon request unless there is an exemption that applies specifically. And the exemption that we looked at and examined in connection with this matter is arises from a statute that applies to the TSPC. It's ORS 342-176, subsection 1. And that's a statute that provides that documents and materials used in the investigation and report of the director are confidential and not subject to public inspection unless the commission makes a final determination as to the disciplinary matter. And you've already heard that the commission treats the final order, as always has, as a record that is available under the public records law upon request, and I understand now as a practice posts those orders as well on its website. The question we looked at in our case, in our order, is whether that the general rule of the public records law applies to settlement agreements of the type described, or instead whether that exemption applies and would allow the TSPC to keep confidential those materials, or indeed would require the TSPC to keep confidential those settlement materials. And the answer we gave, as you can see in the order, is that the public records law controls, and indeed those settlement agreements must be disclosed upon request. So as to the TSPC then, yes, settlement agreements and final orders both are public records that are subject to disclosure, compelled disclosure, upon request. And that's my small part of the contribution to your
are there any questions from commissions? Any questions? Is that clear?
Yeah. Can I
Representative Greenup.
Yeah, the notion of disclosing them on request rather than disclosing them, did you have some relations with that, Mr. Shepherd?
Mr. Chair, Representative Greenlick, I personally didn't engage in advice on that question. Under the public records law, the law does not impose a duty on agencies to affirmatively post in a publicly available way materials. It is the extent of the compulsion of the public records law is to impose on agencies a duty to respond to requests for public records. And so that's as far as our order extended. I don't know whether we provided any advice to TSPC as to the posting of the affirmative posting of those materials, although there wouldn't be any, once we reached the conclusion that they could be compelled by request, there wouldn't be any legal barrier. We wouldn't raise any legal barrier to affirmative disclosure.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative. Who's ever next?
Chair Linda, do you want to go next? Good morning. My name is Linda Guss. I'm an Assistant Attorney General at the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm also the Assistant Attorney in charge of the Human Services Section, primarily given the responsibility to supervise a number of the attorneys that provide legal advice and litigation services to the Department of Human Services Child Welfare Program. I also provide advice to the policymakers, the administrators of the Child Welfare Program, and one of my specific responsibilities is to advise the Child Protective Services Unit administrators in the central office. I've been employed at the Department of Justice since 1988, previously doing termination of parental rights actions in child abuse cases. It's obvious from the discussion that's gone on this morning that many of you know quite a great deal about the child abuse reporting law. So I thought I would just walk through the law very quickly, highlighting some of the primary issues. I provided a handout to the committee. It's an excerpt of the current child abuse reporting law, and that's exactly what it says on the top. It's a five-page document. I've just numbered it in a legal way for ease of reference in case I need to point out a specific provision. First, I'd just like to note that the child abuse reporting law contains specific definitions, definition of abuse, which someone has discussed already this morning, and then of, I think, primary interest to folks here is the definition of a public or private official. There is a list of people who are identified as public or private officials. I'm one of those people because I am an attorney licensed in Oregon, so I am one of the people that is subject to the mandatory child abuse reporting law. You'll also see that school employee is identified also as a public or private official. The mandatory child abuse reporting law imposes on every public or private official a duty to report child abuse. And the duty to report is triggered by a series of elements that must be in place. First, obviously, you have to have a public or private official. People who are not on that list are not mandatory reporters. However, the legislature has specifically articulated a policy to encourage voluntary reports. So even if you're not mandated, you're encouraged to make a report.
School board members then are not, or they are?
Well, it would depend on whether they are would be within the definition of a school employee. There's another school employee is not defined in the child abuse reporting law. I can tell you that we have looked at the history of that specific provision. In 1967, it actually said an elementary school teacher or elementary school nurse with the permission of the principal or superintendent were required to report.
Wow.
That, and actually that was only, they were only required to report for children under 12.
Wow.
If they were abused. In 1971, that was changed so that it required a school teacher, school nurse, or school principal. And then the most recent change, and that actually, again, I believe that was only applicable to children under 12. Actually, I'm sorry, that was changed to children under 15, I'm sorry. And then in 1975, the term school employee was inserted. There's another...
But Mr. Chair, so that's... If the school board was involved with the superintendent in negotiating these secret deals, they're not held under this reporting. And that would be something we need to, you know, we just added legislators in 2003. They're elected officials as a school board member, so they are public officials, but it's not in the list.
Chair Buckley, Representative Wisnett. There's another handout that I provided, which is more specific to child abuse reporting by school employees, and that is one of the first times, at least my knowledge, that the term school employee or education provider has been defined.
Right.
So that may be helpful. Now, this is a statute that's specific to school employees and imposes on school employees and school boards and other identified entities certain responsibilities, and I can talk briefly about that as well.
Thank you.
So the duty to report applies to a public or private official. The duty arises if that public or private official has reasonable cause to believe, one, that they've come into contact with a child who has suffered abuse, or they have come into contact with a person who has abused a child. So the duty arises when there is reasonable cause to believe they've contacted either of those two people, a child abuse victim or a person who may have abused a child.
Can I ask a question at that point? Because I know these are things that keep you very much occupied. But when you try to define reasonable cause,
is this where cases tend to hang with a mandatory person? Well, I didn't think that was enough reasonable cause to report.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, you know, there's not a lot of cases out there that actually speak specifically to child abuse and when a public or private official may or may not have reasonable cause to believe they've come into contact with a person like that. However, we have done some, we've looked at that, and we have opined that it is an objective standard. And that it obviously speaks to the level of belief that a public or private official must have before their duty to report is triggered, and have suggested that that it's based on some specific articulable facts and the inferences that someone can bring from those facts, and that it may also really be a situation where the individual person has to look at the facts and bring the inferences from those facts based upon their own training and their own experience. I might have my duty to report, having the background and experience and knowledge that I have, might be triggered differently than a patent attorney who has no background or experience or knowledge about child abuse. So it's not necessarily, we've thought, you know, something that you can put your finger on. It's really that person looking at the facts that they have, the information they have, and bringing inferences from those facts, and then connecting that with their experience and training, and then figuring out whether they have a duty to report.
Let's follow up first, and I'll get to you. I guess the crux of this is we're talking about people making that decision, what reasonable cause is, and we're talking about these cases where a superintendent might say, I don't have reasonable cause to pass this accusation on to TSPC, but I'm going to get rid of this employee because I feel, personally, I have misgivings about that employee. And that seems to be the gray area that we're in. Is there anything in statute that would point, or rules, or TSPC policy perhaps, that would point to that superintendent and say, if you neglect these specific signs, you are neglecting reasonable cause, evidence of reasonable cause?
Chair Buckley, I can't speak to the duty to report to the TSPC. I'm not knowledgeable about that piece. I'm talking specifically about the mandatory child abuse reporting duty to report to either DHS, the Department of Human Services, or law enforcement. So I do want to be clear about that.
All right, I know I'm mixing them up. I'm just trying to get... Representative Greenlee, do you have a question?
Yeah, I was interested in this direct contact kind of issue that you raised. If let's say I'm talking to a child in some context, I'm a mandatory reporter, and the child says, my sister is being abused by my stepfather under these circumstances. Does that not trigger a mandatory requirements?
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, the term contact is not defined, and I think different people have interpreted it and applied it differently. Does that mean that if I get a letter from someone saying I'm being abused, that's contact, or does it have to be contact like this? So it's not defined, and so I don't have a specific answer for you on that.
Seems to me our training as mandatory reporters was if we have reason to believe. I don't think I ever heard this direct contact thing in our training. I think it's if we have reason to believe there's sexual abuse taking place, we have a mandatory requirement to report it.
Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlick, I want to be clear. The statute doesn't say direct contact. It says contact. And I think it doesn't say direct contact. It says with whom the official comes in contact has suffered abuse. or you have contact with a person who may have abused a child. I think it's important, another point to make, which is it's contact with a child, and child is specifically defined in the child abuse reporting law to be a person under 18 and unmarried. So if you come into person with a child that you have reasonable cause to believe has been abused, and or contact with a person, there's no limitation with regard to your duty to report if you come into contact with a person. It's not, there's no duty that you must report only if that person is currently abusing a child, or if the person, if the child you believe that person abused is still a child. So we have instances where DHS gets reports on people where the person may have abused a child 15 years ago, but the reporter has still come into contact with a person who abused a child. I hope that makes sense.
Yeah, but that's still,
the contact
is troubling me. I mean, I can get information that doesn't, which I wouldn't even prefer I had indirect contact. I just get some information that seems credible to me and leads me to believe that I ought to be reporting it. It would seem to me I have an obligation to report it. And I don't have an obligation to know that it's true. I just have an obligation to have a reasonable suspicion that it's true. I'm assuming.
Chair Buckley, Representative
Greenlee. I suppose this is outside of the context of what we're talking about here today, but in a school that might happen a lot. I mean, somebody comes in and says this kid in the next class had so and so happen. And I imagine that would be pretty common. And that doesn't feel like contact to me.
Again, Chair Buckley, Representative Greenlee, I think that it is that person's duty about to decide when they have had contact, when they have reasonable cause to believe. There are some other issues that may help with that. The duty, I believe, is a personal duty. It's my personal duty. It's not a duty that I can discharge by talking to my supervisor and finding out if they want me to report. It's something I have to personally decide. I do not have a duty to investigate. I don't have a duty to interview the child or interview the person I believe has abused the child or interview anybody else. That is better left to the professionals who can do that, and it then doesn't taint the later investigation. Speaking to a point that you were making, there is immunity for people who make child abuse reports, and let me just say what the immunity statutes provide. The immunity flows to anyone participating in good faith in the making of the report of child abuse who has reasonable grounds for the making thereof. So, and that flows to both mandatory reporters as well as voluntary reporters. Those people are immune from any liability, civil or criminal, that might otherwise be incurred or imposed. So there are immunity provisions which apply to mandatory reporters.
I might interject just for a second. It's a little bit off topic for your committee, but just to reassure you that when Linda conducts training for our own department's lawyers, for example, the prudential advice is to report, to err on the side of reporting, even under the circumstance you described, Representative Greenlee, and that's the kind of counsel we routinely give to state agencies and their personnel as well.
That's what we've been given as well.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because of the immunity provision, and also because it seems to us that our understanding of what the word contact means needs to be informed by the overall purpose of the statute, which is not to have the reporter do the investigation, but rather to bring it to the attention of authorities who can determine effectively whether abuse did occur. So it is, I think, a sidelight to your overall inquiry today, but I didn't want to leave you with the impression that we were erring on the side of not reporting.
Thank you, sir.
Often we don't even talk about the duty. We look at the immunity statute, and I appreciate one of my supervisors. We do very seriously talk about erring on the side of reporting because, of course, the policy is to protect children. The other things I would just note quickly is that the duty arises whether the public or private official is performing their official duties or whether they're at the grocery store or at a baseball game. So mandatory reporters have a duty if they observe anything 24/7 to report. Let's see, I wanted to move on and just talk quickly about the statute regarding child abuse reporting by school employees. That's the other handout I provided you. You can see, as I mentioned earlier, that education provider is defined. Abuse is given the same meaning as it is in the child abuse reporting statute. And these statutes were just recently enacted. I see the enactment date of the first one was 2005. These statutes require that school boards adopt policies on the reporting of child abuse, and you'll note that the policy is supposed to include a requirement that all school employees report a suspected child abuse to law enforcement, DHS, or a designee. There are additional reporting requirements, not just that the policies have to include as well, and that is that they must report the suspected abuse to the employee's supervisor or other person designated by the school board. So there's a duty to report not just to law enforcement or DHS, but also, as the policies require, to the supervisors. And then you'll note that at the bottom of page 2, the statute 339.375 has information about personnel actions, and I think that goes to the question regarding whether that employee may continue to have contact with the child. And I believe that there is a provision here that says when an education provider receives a report of suspected child abuse by one of its employees and the education provider's designee determines there's reasonable cause to support the report, the education shall place the school employee on paid administrative leave until one of the circumstances happens that's identified here. That's just a special statute applicable specifically to school employees.
Would be the punishment or crime?
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mrs. Goose? Is it?
Yes, Gus.
Gus, thank you, Ms.
Uh-huh.
What would be the penalty or crime for violation of these?
The child abuse reporting statutes, let me quickly, I believe it's a Class A misdemeanor.
Class A violation
for the child abuse reporting statutes.
Thank you.
Further questions? Please.
Thank you. Chair Buckley and members of the committee, my name is Raul Ramirez. I'm an assistant attorney general with the Department of Justice. I represent the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission, as well as two other agencies, and I have represented the commission since approximately August of 2006. I'm here to address a couple of issues that hopefully will place how TSPC operates in more context. These are the things that I'm going to discuss, and obviously if you have questions at any point, go ahead and ask. I welcome them. First, I'm going to discuss a little bit of a distinction between the mandatory child abuse reporting that my colleague just discussed from the reporting requirement that applies to chief administrators to report potential misconduct to the commission. Secondly, I'm going to discuss some of the processes that TSPC operates under in the course of its investigations, and specifically what I'm referring to is the confidentiality of those investigations. Lastly, I'm going to address a couple of points that impact the length of time in which TSPC may take a case from the receipt of a complaint to the entry of a final order, and in fact, even going further on, imposing discipline after potential judicial review. So, first of all, I want to start speaking about the distinction that Ms. Gus was talking about, the mandatory child abuse reporting. As she indicated, that is a requirement that applies not just to educators, but to other professionals, including lawyers, doctors, for example, to report when they have a reasonable belief that a child that they come in contact with may have suffered child abuse. And, of course, that's defined under statute, and I won't address the specifics of that. The distinction between that mandatory requirement to report to DHS or to law enforcement and TSPC is as follows. Basically, the mandatory requirement that anyone report to TSPC is that it applies only to chief administrators of a school district. Generally, that tends to be the superintendent. What is the conduct that the superintendent is required to report? Essentially, the conduct falls into two general categories. First is gross neglect of duty, and the second is gross unfitness. Those are two terms that are used under the TSPC statutes that define the general parameters for which educators may be sanctioned by the commission. Now, with respect to gross neglect of duty, as Ms. Chamberlain provided a copy of the Administrative Rules, Division 20, the commission has promulgated rules to define examples so that educators are on notice as to the kinds of conduct that will generally constitute gross neglect of duty. And those are under subsection 40, which I believe begins on page 8 of the handout that Ms. Chamberlain had provided to you. All of the conduct, except for two subsections that are included within those definitions of gross neglect of duty, must be reported by the chief administrator. And the two that are exempted relate to resigning from a school district without adequate notice. And the second one that is included that does not need to be reported is the refusal to cooperate with a TSPC investigation. The second category of conduct, as I mentioned earlier, that must be reported by a chief administrator is gross unfitness. And that is a concept that is more, I suppose if you want to phrase it, more grave conduct that an educator may be engaged in. For example, a mandatory conviction under the statute that would dictate revocation of the license would seem to fall under the category of gross unfitness. But at any rate, those are the two general categories of conduct that the chief administrator must report. Ms. Chamberlain indicated correctly that the chief administrator has a duty to report to TSPC within 30 days from the day that the administrator forms a reasonable belief that the educator may have engaged in the conduct that I just described. So there isn't a requirement on the administrator that he or she know for a fact that the educator violated a particular standard. That we're not holding, or TSPC, to my understanding, is not holding administrators to that that high bar. Basically, I would compare it more along the lines of the child abuse reporting. If you believe that there is a reasonable basis from which there is evidence that an educator has violated a standard, the safe thing to do would be to report to TSPC.
So, Mr. Beckett, thank you. That's exactly the point I was trying to get to with my previous question. It would seem, then, if there is enough reasonable doubt that something has taken place, if an administrator feels that motivated to see if they could work out a deal to get rid of an employee, that administrator would reasonably report that to TSPC. It would cross that level because they don't have to prove anything. They just have to be able to say, I have misgivings, given all the information I've been given, I'm going to pass this on to TSPC.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, I believe that is essentially correct, although I cannot speak to what the particular district or the administrator is thinking about when they're making the decision. Much like the child abuse reporting, those administrators must be able to make their own decisions as to what they are to report. And of course, if TSPC receives information that an administrator has not reported, then there is a weighing of the various decisions that went into or of the various factors that went into deciding whether to report or not.
If I could follow through, in the same context that there's the immunity provision with the child abuse reporting, is a school administrator at all in danger of being held liable for passing information on to TSPC?
Can I ask you to clarify that question?
So, for instance, if an administrator receives a report that a school employee has been engaging in sexual misconduct and believes there's a reasonable cause to pass it on to TSPC, can that school employee in the future sue that school administrator for passing that information on to TSPC?
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, whether the school official has the ability to sue the school district obviously would be up to that person to decide. And obviously, whether there would be any success in that suit, I'm not going to comment on. Does that address your question?
It does. It's not. I'm just trying to find out, in the same way, if there's any kind of liability for a school administrator. Is there anything that would block a school administrator from performing their duty? Is there any case that shows that if they've done that, they put themselves in some sort of jeopardy?
Chair Buckley, there's not a case that I'm aware of. And I guess I would point back to, at least in the hypothetical that you posed, it would appear that there would be immunity under the child abuse reporting. And I want to specify what I mean by that, because one of the last points I was going to make on this area is that although the child abuse reporting and the TSPC reporting by administrators are distinct, there is certainly overlap, mm-hmm. because I believe that for the most part, conduct that constitutes child abuse under the mandatory reporting statute to DHS or to law enforcement would likely constitute gross neglect of duty or gross unfitness that would also be reportable to TSPC.
Thank you.
The next subject that I want to cover briefly is...
Representative Crimmel?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Ramirez, what is defined as a chief administrative officer? Is that the superintendent of the district or the head of the HR department, or would it be a building principal?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, that term is defined under the rule. The definition is found, again, referring to the set of administrative rules that Ms. Chamberlain provided to you. The specific rule is OAR 584, Division 20, Section 41, and it defines the chief administrator under Section 1 as the superintendent, head teacher, or person designated by a school district board as district school clerk under ORS 332.515 of a school district, education service district, or charter school, and B, the chief administrative officer of the Oregon School for the Deaf and the Oregon School for the Blind, or, and I'm not going to read the entire
right.
section, but there's
right.
another
okay.
section there that defines who the chief administrator is for purposes of the rule.
Clarification, please. So if a building principal, if it came to the attention of a building principal, and a building principal then said, well, okay, I don't think I'm covered under this as far as reporting directly to TSPC, so I'm going to report it to my assistant superintendent or to the superintendent. The superintendent decides not to do anything with it, doesn't move it forward to TSPC. I'm just trying to think if there's a potential glitch that could prevent a misconduct being reported that really ought to be reported by somebody in the office. But it looks like from what you've been pointing out here that actually a building principal themselves wouldn't have to take it unless a school district policy is that it goes up this chain of command. Under the Oregon administrative rule, a building administrator could make that and potentially has the duty to make that report directly to TSPC.
Chair Buckley, Representative Carmel, unless a particular educator or building principal fits within the definition of chief administrator under this rule as it is now, they would not have a duty to report, as I understand and interpret this rule.
Okay.
Of course, the failure of the superintendent, who you did mention in your example, if that particular official decides not to report and there was a duty to report and TSPC learns of that, then that person could be subject to potential discipline by the commission.
Okay, thank you.
The next area that I want to cover briefly is what's been touched on a little bit by Ms. Chamberlain and also by my colleague, Mr. Shepherd, and that is that the commission has statutory provisions that relate to the confidentiality of its investigations and the materials that are used in the investigation, as well as the report of the executive director. And that's under ORS 342.176, subsection 4. And essentially what that means, to put it in context of the public records law that Mr. Shepherd had discussed earlier, as Mr. Shepherd indicated, the public records law, as a default, functions as a means by which the public can access any public record. You have to start there. And within that context, there are various exemptions that are provided specifically in the public records law. One of those exemptions is a general exemption that provides that there is no duty to disclose documents that are made confidential by other state or federal laws. And so this statute that I referenced, 342.176, subsection 4, would be a statute that provides for confidentiality of various materials of the TSPC investigations, and therefore there is no duty to disclose. That confidentiality goes away if the commission makes a final determination that the educator has violated the standards that are set forth in statute. And essentially, to be more specific, it would be gross neglect of duty or gross unfitness. Once that happens, the final order obviously would become a record that is not exempt from disclosure. And in fact, as Ms. Chamberlain indicated, those orders are now posted on the TSPC's website for the public to view. The next topic that I want to address is, as I had mentioned earlier, some of the factors that determine the length of time in which TSPC proceeds from receipt of a complaint to entry of a final order and imposition of discipline. And one of those things is that educators, as well as other licensees, have a right to know what charges are being brought against them. And under the statutes that TSPC operates under, as well as under the APA, that's the Administrative Procedures Act, the person is entitled to a plain and ordinary statement that advises them of what the misconduct is. They're also entitled to know their hearing rights that they have with respect to those charges. And to put this in a little bit more context, what I'm speaking of is, if you borrow the term from criminal law, of an indictment. In the administrative setting in which TSPC operates, once an investigation is completed and once the investigation is taken to the commission and the commission makes a determination that there is sufficient cause to proceed to sanction an educator, the commission will communicate that to the educator by means of what the commission calls a notice of opportunity for hearing. That document is the document that needs to advise the educator of the various rights that they have. For example, as I mentioned, they have a right to request a hearing. They have a right to representation of counsel. They have a right to subpoena witnesses. Once that process gets to that point and there is a hearing requested, you have what is known in administrative law as a contested case. At that point, although the commission has made a preliminary determination that there is basis to sanction the educator has not received actual discipline. That process needs to be accomplished through the course of the contested case hearing. Currently, the statutes that TSBC operates under require that the hearing be conducted by an administrative law judge from the Office of Administrative Hearings. And once we're at that stage, the commission, and by that I'm including Ms. Chamberlain as well as the investigators, are more removed from the process, and the case comes over to our office, the Attorney General's office, to handle the representation of the commission at the contested case hearing. At that stage, the length of time that it can take to take the case to hearing depends on the nature of the case. It depends on the ALJ that is assigned, and obviously it depends on the schedules of the various parties that are involved. Generally, that process involves the acknowledgement from the Office of Administrative Hearings that they have received a referral from the commission or from our office for that case. There is a pre-hearing conference set, and that pre-hearing conference may be set out as soon as 30 days out, or it may be as long as 30 or 60 or 90 days out. The pre-hearing conferences are scheduled so that there is a beginning dialogue between the parties to the administrative law judge who's going to be hearing the case to know what the issues are. What is the basis on a general level that the commission is going to be proposing a sanction on this educator? Once that happens, generally most cases would be scheduled for hearing. And again, hearings may be scheduled as soon as 3 months after the pre-hearing conference, or it could take, and I'm being general here because every case is different, it could take 4 or 5 months to actually get a hearing date at which all the parties are available. Between the time that there is the pre-hearing conference and that there is the hearing date, there is often an exchange of information, which is called discovery. My office, if the commission has not previously provided information to the educator, provides basically all of the documents that we intend to rely on at the hearing to establish that the educator engaged in a particular misconduct. And so that also takes time. There is an opportunity for the educators, as well as other licensees and other agency cases, to make motions regarding the nature of the allegations. And all of those things, once they're at that process, are essentially, to a large degree, at the discretion of the ALJ. The ALJ may determine that if the educator has not received information, or if there are certain issues that have not been resolved in terms of legal motions, that there is a need to postpone the hearing. Once the hearing takes place, the hearings remain confidential at that point. Technically, it could still be considered an investigation because under administrative law, the theory is that the hearing is a fact-finding forum. At that stage, the evidence is taken from the witnesses, the records are introduced, and in basically all cases, the administrative law judge will take the case under advisement. They have anywhere from 30 to 45 days between the time that they hear the evidence to when they issue a proposed order, which takes us into yet another stage before the commission can take any final action. The proposed order is essentially a document that contains findings of fact and conclusions of law that the administrative law judge believes were established. It also contains a recommended sanction or, in some cases, a recommendation that the charges be dismissed. That order is called a proposed order because it is not a final action. In the situation where the proposed order indicates what the relief that the commission asked for example, if the commission at the time of the hearing, and I want to be very clear, by commission, I tend to talk about the representation that I provide as though I am the commission, but in fact, if as an advocate of the commission, I am asking that the proposed sanction be suspension, and the proposed order reflects that a suspension is warranted, the educator then has 21 days within to file what are known as exceptions. And essentially those are objections to various findings that the administrative law judge made, why certain facts do not apply to the conclusions that are drawn, and ultimately, from the educator's standpoint, why they shouldn't receive the sanction that was proposed or they should receive a lesser sanction. At that stage, the commission can then consider the proposed order along with the exceptions that were filed and can also consider oral argument from the educator as to those exceptions. At that point, the commission can deliberate on all of the information in the record and issue a final order. The final order serves as the actual sanction on the educator. In my example, it would be a final order imposing a suspension, which would include the findings of fact, the conclusions of law, and the sanction that it's going to impose the commission. At that stage, normally you would think that the case is final, and in a sense it is, but the educator also has 60 days from the entry of the final order within which to seek judicial review from the Court of Appeals. And once that occurs, unless the commission has made a specific finding that it is, and I need to look at the specific language under the statute, but
we're not addressing the subject that we need advice here.
I'm unable to find it, but essentially, unless the commission makes a finding that it is essential that the educator not be in the school because of some danger or danger to the well-being or safety of the students, then the filing of the petition for review to the Court of Appeals functions as a stay on the final order. So if that occurs, the educator has not been sanctioned. From that point, we get into the second area that I'm briefly going to discuss, which is judicial review. And actually, I've already covered some of those points. So once the case goes to the Court of Appeals, it's anybody's guess how long that takes. There's months that go by between the filing of the petitioner's brief, the respondent's brief, and the reply brief, and ultimately a decision is reached by the Court of Appeals. And even then, there are some cases, and there was one recent case that involved the commission, which went to the Oregon Supreme Court, and that extends the time from which, going back to where I started, the commission receives a complaint to the entry of a final order.
The wheels of justice is impressive.
Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate all this testimony, and we've learned a lot today. But, you know, we're really here today because it wasn't reported. We're here because we've got the press looking at some bad things that happened in our system. I understand that we have a system and we got a backlog and we're trying to work on that to adjudicate those charges. What we need, we got $600 worth of legal advice in front of us here, probably a couple hundred dollars an hour.
More than that.
We need to know what kind of legislation we need to do to punish those people who did these secret deals instead of reporting and getting it in the system, like you've so well described today that we have this system, and Mrs. Chamberlain has a system. She's came up with a couple of legislative suggestions, but I would appreciate your legal advice on, you know, what happened, how do we stop these people making the secret deals, and if that's jeopardizing our children, and how do we get that done? What legislative action? I understand what we do when we get it reported, but these were not reported. So that's what we need your advice on, I think, Mr. Chair, as far as what do we do to be sure these superintendents or school boards, whoever, are not reporting and making the secret deals that endanger our children.
Mr. Chair, if I could just comment on my colleague's comment. I don't think we're here to punish these people. I think we're here to try and find legislative ways to avoid this in the future.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, to both of your colleagues' suggestions, one thing that occurs to me, and I wouldn't presume to advise you as to the wisdom of the policy choice, but we discussed how the child abuse reporting statute does have a built-in immunity provision, which is a linked immunity provision, which is intended to facilitate the goal that I think you all are discussing, is how to encourage the report of matters that ought to come before the TSPC for its consideration and possible discipline. And one thing you might consider as a committee looking at is whether there is a way to craft some kind of, to the extent that there may be an impediment to making reports of, now we're dealing with non-child abuse kinds of misconduct reports, but to the extent that there may be some impediment through fear of liability, for example, it might be productive for the committee to look at the extent to which it could perhaps remove that barrier by creating something akin to the child abuse immunity provision. Now, I do have to tell you that it's a kind of at risk of putting you all to sleep, there's a complicated constitutional overlay here. And that is the Oregon Supreme Court has construed elements of the Oregon Constitution to limit the Assembly's authority to eliminate altogether, at least, liability under some kinds of circumstances. So you'd need some careful assistance from legislative counsel in working your way through the potential limitations of that. But that would be one productive area that my lawyer's ear has heard in your hearing today that might be responsive to your question.
It's an excellent point, and we have been looking into that, and I believe Colorado has done some steps in that direction. We already have in law that employer disclosed information in good faith is immune from civil liability for such disclosure, but I'm not sure what the case law is that in our state and how that's been interpreted. I do, Mr. Minister, just to go back to your testimony, which I appreciate very much. Just to clarify, the entire time that process is taking place, by our statute, that employee is on paid administrative leave. And can that employee resign from their position with the school district and apply for another position with another school district while they're on paid administrative leave, and why this process is taking place?
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, I want to clarify. The circumstances that I described generally do not necessarily involve an educator who is on leave.
Correct.
That
in the circumstances that do require paid administrative leave, if it's a sexual misconduct case, am I correct in the statement that they would be, if they're going through the process of appeals that you're talking about, they would be on paid administrative leave?
I believe, at least at the initial stage, that there's a determination made by the district that conduct occurred, they would be placed on administrative leave. Whether they would, the educator would be able to apply to another school district, I have not personally considered that. I could certainly look into it and consult with Ms. Chamberlain and provide additional information to you.
It's also true, I believe, that the district could take their own action with respect to discharging that teacher, regardless of whether there has been an outcome yet at TSPC.
And that's absolutely true. We can't forget that we've been discussing the distinctions between mandatory child abuse reporting and TSPC reporting. There's also a distinction between TSPC action on the license of the educator versus personnel action that school districts take or can take against their employees.
Additional questions for this panel? Thank you very much. I think we'll be seeing more of you in the future. I greatly appreciate your time and your testimony today. At this point, members, we've covered a lot of ground, but if there's anybody else who would like to testify on this issue that we have before us, you're welcome to do so now. If not, I will close the informational meeting on protecting children from sexual abuse in schools and open up a informational meeting, a report on House Bill 2848,
from this past session, and are we going to have folks from the department come up and let us know how that is evolving for us? And then I don't know if you want to wait for the department to remind us.
My pleasure. Absolutely. We'll meet again in June, and if you heard the joint meeting in June, the Senate committee.
Mr. Chair, I think I'm sure the department plans to just briefly give us the context of what the rules that they're presenting are.
Got a thumbs up from the department. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While my colleagues are getting the handouts to committee staff, I'll go ahead and start and give you that context. For the record, my name is Morgan Allen, Legislative Director for the Department of Education. Thank you. If you remember back, it seems so long ago, but during the 2007 legislative session, what brings us here today was the chair and vice chair of the Senate Education and General Government Committee added an amendment to House Bill 2848 when it came to the Senate side. And as you know, that bill is obviously signed into law by the governor. And I believe Ms. Richardson's given you a copy of the enrolled bill, but the pertinent part of it for today is it's on page 6 of the enrolled bill, and I'll just read from it very quickly. It says, quote, "The State Board of Education shall submit for review by the legislative committees on education or the interim legislative committees on education as appropriate any proposed rules to implement requirements for a diploma, a modified diploma, or an alternative certificate prior to the adoption of those rules by the board." So in short, essentially that means before the State Board of Education takes a final vote on any proposed OARs that relate in any way to the diploma, modified diploma, or alternative rules, they need to be shared with the education committees.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, which section are you reading, please?
It's on page 6 of the
enrolled bill.
Number 7.
Section 10, sub 7.
Yeah,
great,
sorry.
Thank you. Under Section 10. Section 10, number 7.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Excuse me. Section 10, sub 7. And so, again, in short, that just basically, it's kind of vague. And so we're doing a little trial run here today, essentially, Mr. Chair.
Right.
Since you were meeting and we do have a couple of rules prepared, we thought we'd come in person. And I think we'll just need to work with the committees. You know, your interim committee timelines don't exactly line up with the state board's timelines. And I think it's good that there is some flexibility within that description there, is whether we could do them in writing or, you know, email them to you and things like that. But we'll want to work with the chairs of both committees to make sure those are done. So today we have three rules to talk about. And the first rule is OAR 581-022-1130. And that includes language that will implement Representative Crummell's bill from last session, House Bill 2606. And if you remember, that was the bill that dealt with the issue of allowing students to advance a grade when they're ready, and also allowing students, when they've completed the credits and they have the permission of their parents, et cetera, to receive their diploma and graduate early. And I have with me Dr. Salam Noor, who's our Assistant Superintendent for Educational Improvement and Innovation, and he's going to talk about that rule. And just so you guys know, too, that rule also contains more than just the 2606 provisions. Remember, the quote I just gave you from the enrolled House Bill 2048, it says any provision. So we're not just here to talk about bills you may have passed this last session, but we're also here to give you an update on anything related to diplomas and alternative certificates and the like. So,
do we have the material on 3.0? I find 3.4 and 3.5.
Yeah.
It's clear down on the bottom of the pile.
Right.
Representative.
It's a separate stapled set of information. I think it's the very last item in here.
It appears to be in 10 font.
We promise it is in 12, Representative Collins.
I assure you, I don't think it is.
And then we have two rules that go together. The second group of rules, OAR 581-022-1134 and OAR 581-022-1135. And those actually implement the provisions of House Bill 2848, which essentially create a standardized statewide modified diploma and an alternative certificate, and put those into statute. And we've got Eric Richards, who's our Director of Operations for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships, who's here to discuss those with you. So just to kind of give you guys a little bit more context, essentially these rules that you have before you today have not been first read before the State Board of Education. The rule that Dr. Noor is going to discuss that includes House Bill 2606, there's going to be a public hearing on that. April 23rd, I believe, is the date. And the intention now is that that rule be presented to the board for the first time at their May meeting. the two other rules related to alternative certificate and modified diploma, there was actually a public hearing about a week and a half ago, and we've included the hearings officer report from that hearing with the materials that we've given you. And those rules will be heard next week for the first time at the State Board of Education meeting, which is the 17th and 18th of April. So the rules that we actually, the OAR and State Board process can be a little bit different. Essentially, we can disseminate the rules, draft the rules, distribute them to members of the public, have public hearings on them before they've technically been introduced before the board. So just to make that, it's a little bit of a difference from the process that you guys go through. So these gentlemen will go through the rules, explain them to you, and hopefully we can answer any questions. We also have Cindy Hunt, who's our legal affairs coordinator, who also handles all of our OAR process for the state board and helps draft those rules and guide them through the process. She's here too. If any of the three of us get hung up, we can throw our lifeline to Cindy Hunt and drag her up here. So with that, I'd be happy to answer your questions, and if not, I'll turn it over to my colleagues.
It was nice to hear you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I apologize to Mr. Allen that the documents that you have provided are in 12 font.
Thank you, Vice Chair.
Thank you. Chair Buckley, members of the committee, for the record, Salam Noor, Oregon Department of Education.
Yeah.
And as Morgan indicated, I will be addressing two rules with you. One is the Oregon Administrative Rules based on House Bill 2606, and the other one is based on policy that the State Board of Education enacted in January of 2007 relative to new graduation requirements. So if I may direct your attention to the document that's 581022-1130, if I may direct your attention to the last page, and I will begin by addressing House Bill 2606 and the provisions within that piece of legislation. And then I will put that into the broader context of the rules that govern diploma requirements and graduation in the state of Oregon. So House Bill 2606, adopted in the 07 legislative session, basically allows students to complete high school in less than 4 years, and it gives them the authority to request to be exited from high school if they complete all of the requirements established by the State Board of Education and their local school board in less than 4 years. It also gives students the opportunity to be advanced to the next grade, if you will, if they've completed the requirements established for each one of those benchmarks and grade levels. Technically, it establishes a proficiency-based diploma that allows students to accelerate their learning and not have to be in school for 4 years, and it gives them the authority and their parents to request that the school essentially releases that student and graduates them rather than retain them for 4 years. And it also supports proficiencies and competencies that can be demonstrated by students at any point in their educational curriculum, educational continuum, if you will, that allow them to advance to that next level, whether it's a course, whether it's taking them to the next year, or engaging in even post-secondary activities while in high school. So the rule essentially states what's in the legislation. I mean, it's very clear, it's very explicit. Mm-hmm. It provides students the opportunities to negotiate with their district whether they're ready to move on to that next stage or not. I'll be happy to answer questions about this, but if you don't mind, I'd like to put it in the broader context, because
please.
I believe the new diploma requirements also provide students similar opportunities. And if I may draw your attention to the yellow sheet, and then I will share with you how that translates into rules. But by way of background, the State Board of Education adopted new diploma requirements for students to graduate from high school starting in 2012, in January of 2007. And those new diploma requirements maintain the 24 credits that were established by the legislature in the 05 session by adding a unit of math and a unit of language arts, but they increased the science credits by one, and they also increased the opportunities for students to earn credits in second language, the arts, and career and technical educations from 1 to 3. But they maintained the 24 credit requirements. They also identified a set of essential skills that they want to make sure students demonstrate proficiency in before they exit high school. The idea behind that is that if a student actually completes 4 units of language arts, they have to have some level of proficiency in reading, writing, speaking, communicating, and the board is interested in holding students accountable for that in order to receive their diploma. And the board is also as explicit that there must be multiple pathways for students to demonstrate proficiency on that. So by establishing these new requirements for the class of 2012 and also the Algebra 1 level and above math requirements for students graduating in 2014, the rules needed to be modified to allow for these different requirements at the different stages that they come online with. So the diploma requirements rules are established by the Board of Education and is based on modifications of existing rules in Division 22. And if I may draw your attention, on the first page you will see under item 2, units of credit requirements for students graduating before July 1, 2009, which means 22 units plus the additional requirements. On the second page,
Where are you at again?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. On the first page, item 2.
1130?
Yes, 1130. 581-022-1130. The way we organize the rules is by categorizing them based on the year of graduation when those requirements will actually come online. So there will be some requirements for the class of 2000 students that graduate before 2009, and that is the 22 units that are currently in place. If you turn the page, item number 3 shows the requirements for students that are graduating after July 1, 2009, and that actually puts into effect the additional math and language arts requirements that were established by the 05 session. If you go to the bottom of that same page, we begin to list the requirements for students to graduate in 2012, which maintains the 24 credit requirements, the current requirements, plus the essential skills. And on the following page, item 5, lists the requirements that will be in place for the graduating class of post-July 2014, which puts into place the math requirements of the Algebra 1 level and above. So if you go back to House Bill 2606, that is actually nested in this particular administrative rules because it pertains to graduation and earning a diploma in the state of Oregon. So as you look at this document, items that are underlined are ones that have been modified or changed completely. You see items that are crossed out, and items in bolded language are new additional language that did not exist in the rule prior to bringing it to you and taking it to the board. So with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you might have.
I'd just like to clarify a statement you made, which I think is important, is the State Board is interested in finding ways for the essential skills to be documented, and they're seeking information from districts currently on how that might best be implemented.
Yep. Chair Buckley, members of the committee, you're absolutely right. The board has engaged the stakeholders over the last couple of years in a variety of ways, including surveys, leanings documents, basically different forums where there has been some face-to-face meetings to gather information to react to the diploma requirements. And now we're at the assessment stage of the essential skills, and the board will issue a leanings document to solicit input and feedback from all stakeholders, both private and public institutions, businesses, community members, parents, et cetera. Yes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crowell.
Thank you. The one question I have is with regards to the math and the notion of Algebra 1 being the minimum. Don't get me wrong, I fully support that. But I'm wondering, because we do have kids out there that, you know what, they're just never going to get it. I mean, you can tutor them, you can work with them, it just isn't there to understand, you know, all of the Algebra 1 concepts to be able to pass. Is that based on like a basic Algebra 1, or is that based on what might be considered a standard Algebra 1? Obviously, it's not based on an honors or advanced placement. I understand that. But I'm just curious how we're measuring that, or are we looking at that as part of the essential skills process? Because a kid that has gone through and done well in school, but maybe math is that one thing that they just don't quite get, and now all of a sudden they can't get their high school diploma because of it. But at the same time, I absolutely agree with having high standards. So it's kind of a balancing act.
Right.
Chair Buckley, Representative Kremel, that's really a great question, and the board struggled with that, and that's why they moved the timeline to 2014 to allow schools to build capacity and to figure out how they're going to help all students achieve that standard. The Algebra 1 content is based on the Oregon content standards that are delineated by basically learning objectives. Mm-hmm. So there are some standards that represent the knowledge and skills that students will be able to demonstrate as a result of participating in Algebra 1 level coursework. And I purposefully say that because the board was fully cognizant of the fact that students have different needs, different goals, different aspirations, but also different learning styles and different abilities, if you will. And that's why they allowed, if you look at the documents, we don't have those here, but basically they are willing to consider other ways for students to demonstrate proficiency in those Algebra 1 standards, if you will. Okay. So a construction technology class may be a vehicle for a student to demonstrate that they understand these concepts and these principles and they're able to apply them in a different setting. An automotive technology course may be a place where they can also demonstrate some of these concepts and principles. The board also expanded the definition of science, recognizing that if we have 3 units of traditional lab science that may have some physical space limitations and some resource limitations for districts, therefore science could be, based on the science standards, applied in a variety of settings. It could be in a pre-engineering course. It could be in a forestry course, mm-hmm. in an agricultural science course. So I think the board is fully cognizant that the level of math is challenging, but they're affording schools and districts some flexibility as to how to meet that, provided that whatever courses and experiences the students engage in are standards-based. And I think the intent behind establishing a level of math is that we want to have some uniformity across the state as to what we mean by Algebra 1, because students in Lake County should really have the same level of access to rigorous content and rigorous curriculum as students in Beaverton or Portland or Eugene. So the board is trying to establish some uniformity as to what do we mean by these courses so students are equally prepared to move on to that next step.
So if I may follow up, Mr. Chair. So it's not necessarily saying that Algebra 1 has to appear on the student's transcript. Mm-hmm. It could be that the school district says Algebra 1 concepts and the state standards for Algebra 1 are met through mm-hmm. these other courses. Right. And the student has taken those, and those are the courses that are showing up on the student's transcript. Right. So consequently, there's been a demonstration that the student, assuming that it was a passing grade and some of the other things, that the student has met the Algebra 1 state standard through these other courses.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. Great. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Good question. Thank you, Representative. I think we'll move on to you then.
Okay. Good morning, Chair Buckley and members of the committee. My name is Eric Richards, and as Morgan indicated earlier, I'm from the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. Our office was charged with developing rules for the alternate certificate and the modified diploma to clarify and implement House Bill 2848. Before I get started, I have several materials I've provided to you. The first looks like this. And it's a very extensive document that lists all of the testimony, both oral and written, that was received by the hearing date of March 26. So it's just a reference document for you. Secondly, you have a copy of the rules, OAR proposed 581, Division 22, Section 1134 and 1135 for the modified diploma and alternative certificate. And then embedded in my testimony today, I'm going to try to provide a high-level report on the feedback that we received from oral and written testimony and how that affected the rule that we drafted, how that changed as a result of that in sections of the rules. So I could begin with some general information on both rules. In the process of receiving public input, we received 118 comments, which is quite a few. And 21 different people responded through oral or written comments. And they came from a diverse group of stakeholders. I think it's also important to point out that we've had a very diverse group of stakeholders working in a task force to put together these rules. And Jackie Burr, who is here behind me today, has facilitated that work group. And we appreciate the work that she's done. Of the comments that we received, we determined that 15 of them were very positive about the rule that was drafted. 65 were negative or expressed some concern with a small part or various sections of the rules as written, and 38 would be considered neutral comments. We had 27 comments that resulted in consideration, but with no specific changes made to either one of the proposed rules. And then I'd like to begin with Section 1, and I will try to move through this with the highlights of each section that came from the comments and answer any questions that you might have along the way here. In Section 1, we are looking at definitions. And we received 9 comments on this particular section. One of them applies to removing the term education plan from this particular section. And the reason for that is you will note in Section 9 on page 3, we refer to an education plan. And what we are trying to do there is align the language to the rule that exists for general education diploma. Also, we received 7 suggested definitions that we did not feel needed to be included in the definition section, and in the detailed comment sheets, you can find those on pages 6 through 7, or I would be happy to walk through those with you upon the conclusion of this if you would like. We also revised the definition for a modified course. We took out the term modified, and we put in, at the request of several people, systematically changed or altered is the language that we felt would better describe the course. Moving into Section 2, the receipt of modified diplomas demonstrating an ability to meet the full set of academic context standards, even with reasonable accommodations. There were 7 comments received. And that resulted in the removal of the term modifications from the section. This is not a special education rule. It's a general education rule. And accommodation is the word that's used in that rule. And the term modification is incongruent with regular courses giving regular credit, was the reasoning for that. In Section 3, we had 17 comments. Rejected the suggestions to specify details around a documented history. We felt that documented history ought to be defined by school districts. We also removed the words due to a disability, as this is, again, not a special education regulation, and by putting that in there, we could risk violations of FERPA. And we also included language regarding an exception for documented illegal use of drugs and or alcohol based on Section 504. Again, this is not a special education regulation, but many students who are affected by this rule will be on an IEP or a 504 plan, and we did not want students who fell into the category of documented illegal use of drugs and or alcohol to have the opportunity to get the modified diploma. Section 4, we had 3 highlights in that particular section. The language requiring that a parent guardian be included in the school team is included in 4A and is pretty self-explanatory. And then also there was clarified language used in Section 4B and 4C. And the main changes there were, previous to this new revised set of rules, we were looking at 5th grade and 3 years before anticipated exit from high school, and felt that it would be better to list it at 6th grade because that aligns with middle school when credits start to be given, and also with 2 years rather than 3, so that students might not be pigeonholed into the modified diploma, but there would be a longer period of time for a decision to be made and for people to be working toward a general diploma. We also rejected the suggestion to notify parents in writing because we felt that it would cause excessive burden on school districts to do so. In Section 5, we had 18 comments, and there was two forms of action taken in that. First of all, the language in 5A and 5B was revised to reflect more English language arts credits and to reduce social science credits. Previously, it was two English language arts and three for science. Of course, reading is the crux of this. And also, you would note later in Section 5, it talks about students having access to literary instruction until the completion of school. So we felt that that needed to be revised. We also rejected a suggestion to use examples within the regulations. We did not feel that the regulations were the place for examples, that that should be done through technical assistance and professional development. And to define seat time, we did not feel that it should be defined within the regulation. Section 6, continuum of instruction from basic skills to high-level skills. There were no changes in that particular section.
Eric, you made a comment about seat time not being defined in the regulation, but isn't seat time already defined in the regulation? Isn't for high school it's 990 hours, for middle school it's 900 hours, and for elementary I think it's, 825 hours? Of instruction per school year, I think is how it is. I'm just trying to remember where it is in the rule, in the administrative rule.
You are correct. I don't believe I explained that well enough. We felt that in that particular section of the OAR, it didn't need to be in there. If you look further in Section 5, there's a section that talks about students having the option to earn credit for demonstrating proficiency. This is subsection D, and the group that worked on this felt that that adequately addressed the issue of seat time.
That's your comment. I'm sorry, Representative Carmel.
It's also in Division 22, seat time.
Representative Carmel?
Okay, so it's also in Division 22. This is Division 22.
Okay.
That's your comment.
Well, that. Dr. Knorr, respond.
Oh, please.
Thank you, Chair Buckley, members of the committee. Division 22 is a fairly large document, and it actually represents all administrative rules based on Oregon statutes that govern education in the state of Oregon. So what you're seeing here is really our subsets of that. The document is but this thick.
Right.
And the administrative rules do specify the number of instructional hours required for elementary, middle, and high schools, and also the number of instructional hours required to earn a credit in the state of Oregon, which is a total of 130 hours per credit. So all of the things that you've referenced are included in that document that represents Division 22 OARs, and this is just a subset of it.
Okay. Then for clarification, Dr. Knorr, how to describe it, a scenario. Okay, so I am going to get a modified diploma. I'm a seventh grader, and there's two questions here. So do I have to put in, can we look at the is this looking at the competency rather than the seat time for the modified diploma?
Go ahead.
Either one of you.
I'm going to let you answer it, and then I'll add. Just want to make sure I get it right.
I have with me the person who worked on these rules and has chaired the group, and I'm going to ask Jackie Burr if she could come forward and respond to that.
Okay. Thank you, Jackie. Could you just state your name for the record? Great.
Thank you. These.
Please state your name for the record before you answer the question.
I'm sorry. That's I'm okay. Hearing impaired, so you'll have
oh,
to
I'm
speak
sorry.
Up to me.
My apologies.
Okay. My name is Jackie Burr, and I work with the Oregon Department of Education and the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships.
Thank you.
There are two things that I wanted to clarify here. Regular credits for an Oregon high school diploma are based on standards. credits for a modified diploma would also be based on standards, but the standards would be modified. And those credits would not count toward an Oregon high school diploma, but they would count toward an Oregon modified diploma. So it would be based on competencies, but not based on the competencies for an Oregon high school diploma. It also would be based on seat time, because these students are expected to be in school as much as any student in a high school. We have asked for 24 credits to get a modified diploma, which, as you can tell, it would take a complete high school career to earn the 24 credits, just the same as it would for a high school diploma. Does that explain it?
Yes.
Chair Buckley, members of the committee, Representative Cotton, if I may add to that. So the principle of proficiency, credit for proficiency, is maintained throughout.
Yes.
And the student will have the option to participate in coursework and activities where they're able to demonstrate proficiency and receive credit, whether it's the regular credit for the regular diploma or credit that's based on the modified diploma. So I think in principle that feature of the diploma will apply to all kinds of scenarios and situations governing the issuing of credits by schools and districts.
Yes.
Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you, Representative.
And Mr. Chair,
Representative,
Demonstration of proficiency is determined by the individual school, correct?
Chair Buckley, Representative Kummel, the Board of Education actually adopted a policy in 2002 to allow districts to issue credit based on proficiency. And the requirement was for districts to establish a policy for issuing that credit based on a criteria that was established by the
right.
State Board. Currently, under the new diploma, that provision almost becomes a requirement, and especially with House Bill 2606 that
right.
says a student can actually request a diploma from a district before the completion of those 4 years. So currently we have a task force comprised of K-12 administrators and educators. We have community college and university partners and others helping us take that proficiency notion to the next level, where we have some clear definitions, clear guidelines, because we want to make sure that when a credit is granted that it really means something, that we have fidelity in the implementation of that notion. So right now districts are required to establish their own policy. We're hoping to expand on that and provide them some guidelines that really inform that policy in a more clear and more definitive way, if you will, because students will also be able to take that credit and transfer it from district to district, and we want to make sure that it's truly representative of the knowledge and skills that it's been granted for.
Right.
So we have some more work to do in that area, but it's becoming a central feature of the Oregon diploma, that students can actually earn credit based on demonstration of knowledge and skills in a variety of ways in a variety of settings, and they may not need to sit through a class. They may not need to sit through 130 hours of seat time to earn that credit. They might be able to demonstrate it through challenge exams, through demonstration projects, through a variety of ways.
Under the current rules also, isn't there a provision in there that a district's policy has to be at least reviewed, if not approved, by the Oregon Department of Education? Have I misread that?
Chair Buckley, Representative Crummell, I believe you are correct. But right now it's an option. It's really, and not all districts have actually taken up that option. However, since it's part of Division 22, Division 22 rules, districts on an annual basis submit an assurance statement to the department indicating that they are compliant with all of those rules. When we go out and do monitoring visits, we also look at Division 22 rules to make sure that they are in place. So there is a mechanism to ensure that that is being implemented.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I'm going to try to end the hearing in about 9 minutes if we can, if it's possible to move through the materials you're presenting. I greatly appreciate it.
Chair Buckley, Section 8 is credit toward a modified diploma. We rejected the suggestions that we received to reword the section. There was a suggestion to clarify it, but we felt that it was clear enough. Section 9, courses for the modified diploma must contain substantial academic content. We reworded Section 9 based on the feedback that we received. We defined it by aligning it with the rule for general education diploma. And then in Section 10, parents must be notified when the course is modified. We did make a change in a word. It was previously syllabi, and we changed that to course. And then we felt that informing the parent in writing would cause excessive burden on the school district, and there are many opportunities through school team meetings to have that conversation. Section 11, regarding transcripts, the term due to disability was removed from the regulation for the same reason as we mentioned in Section 3, FERPA, confidentiality concerns. No actions taken in Section 12. The language was clarified in Section 13, and the main thing was a simple change from the word A to the, so that school districts would not possibly have a motive to have separate graduation ceremonies for kids with modified diplomas. And then there were no actions taken in Section 14. And moving on to the alternative certificate proposed rule, OAR 581, Division 22, Section 1135. No action was taken in Sections 1 and 2, and Section 3, the same change as I just mentioned with the modified diploma rule. We took out and put the in to prevent separate ceremonies from happening. That concludes our report on the development of these rules. And if you have any questions, we'd be happy to answer them.
John, do you have anything?
Yeah, just a couple of comments to kind of wind it up for you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to remind the committee that, again, these are draft rules, mm-hmm. and that the State Board of Education will be hearing from these gentlemen and others in our department as these make their way through the process. So it is hopefully not going to change a lot, but it is possible that the final rules for adoption may change somewhat from the drafts that you see here today. So I would encourage members of the committee, if there are any things within these rules you have concerns about or comments, feel free to send them to Ms. Richardson, and she can get them to me, and I can make sure they get to the board members in time for the meetings where we're actually discussing these. And then I also need to speak to Representative Gelser, who is the chief sponsor of House Bill 2848. She's been very involved in the drafting of the administrative rule, and we've had several meetings on that. And I think we're pretty close to sort of getting there. There's one issue that we need to discuss with her around alternate assessments as a criteria. And so I'm going to hopefully be talking to her today about that. So we're talking to the chief sponsors of these as well. So.
I greatly appreciate that. I greatly appreciate the time and consideration given to Representative Gelser on this. She apologizes for not being able to be here today. But, again, I greatly appreciate your openness and willingness to work with her on this. And I'm sure Representative Crummell would be always interested to work on the bills that he has pushed forward as well.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. When is the board going to hear these for the first time?
The modified diploma and alternative certificate will be next week, the 17th and 18th. The board is meeting. And again, there was a hearing at late March. Those were where the comments came from. And then the one that includes your bill, 2606, that will be, there'll be a public hearing April 23rd, and those will be heard at the May board meeting. And I can get you those dates. I can't remember when the board's meeting may off the top of my head. So.
That'd be great. Thank you.
Dr. Miller, do you plan to go out and meet with faculty members around the state? I mean, you described the process we're going through with greater clarity than anyone else I've heard thus far, so I'd love to have you speak to the teachers throughout the state. I've already gotten comments from different teachers in my district who are concerned about how we're going about this. I really appreciate the way you present it.
Yeah. Chair Ruckley, we would be more than happy to do that. We are trying to... We're trying to communicate this information in a variety of ways, and it's really imperative to get it in the hands of teachers. That seems to be a big challenge for us. We have actually spoken to administrative groups through through COSA, and actually through the state boards, the Oregon School Boards Association's meetings and conferences. We have 5 task forces that are working on various elements of the diploma, and on those task forces we have teachers, administrators, community members, businesses. We have faculty from higher ed participating, and we're trying to do everything we possibly can to engage everyone in in a variety of ways, but also we would be happy to go out and share information with teachers and educators and other groups as well.
Jim, thank you so much for your time. Greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
Members, thank you for your time, consideration, and your tolerance for going over. This is all very important materials we're covering. I learned a lot today on all subjects we're talking about. I look forward to the work ahead. Again, we're going to try to find a date in June where we can meet jointly with the Senate Committee on the TSVC issue. Then we'll be trying to meet again in September and one more in October. That's our goal for the interim. And with that, if there's no other comments.
I just want to say thanks for having it available for me to do this by phone, and sorry for my little interruption early when I finally figured out how the phone
works. Thanks for hanging in there with us, Arnie. Appreciate it. Okay, we are adjourned.